Delmark Records founder Bob Kester, Chicago writers Irvine Welsh and Don DeGrazi, and live music in Studio 435 with indie rockers My Gold Mask. And now here's your host, a man who takes all his confidential business calls in the dining room at Wendy's, Justin Kaufman.
That's true. I get myself a big beef chili, maybe a couple junior bacon cheeseburgers, and I talk about, you know, ballistic missile launches. It's what I do. Welcome, everybody, to another thrilling edition of The Download here on WGN Radio, 720 WGN, till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. We have a tremendous show lined up for you for bye week. We are in hockey bye week. It's a new thing. Yeah. You know, I've said on this program many a times that, you know, I'm a Blackhawks fan, but I'm not a rabid, loyal fan who knows all the ins and outs of every player and everything about the game. So when I said yesterday, it's bye week, what's bye week? The first thing in my head, I was like, oh man, I should pay attention. Bye week is probably a traditional thing that has been with hockey for 60 years. No, this is the first year for it. Bye week for the Chicago Blackhawks this week. What that means for us is we got a week full of shows, which includes we will be doing what Roe and Anna just did. We'll be at the auto show on Friday, wrapping it up. Always a good time because that's the 7 to 11 shift. That's when people are, you know, Friday night. They've chosen to spend their Friday night watching us do a radio show from the auto show. Oh, no, they're going to the auto show. Never mind. A steady stream of people with tickets going, I don't know what that white noise is in the background, but I need to find. They still got the geo tracker? I'm looking for a geo tracker. Well, we've got an outstanding week of programming for you. We're excited to bring you shows, as well as a Northwestern Wildcats game. They're going to play on Wednesday against Maryland. That's a big one. And what a game yesterday. Yes! I was trying really hard in my household to keep that game on with the Grammy pre-show and everything else in between. I mean, it was like, you know, it's funny because Pete and I were talking before the show just about the idea of so many musicians on the Grammy red carpet. And you're like, oh, if you listen to the program, you listen to Download, you know, we have a lot of musicians on the program. It feels like I would be in the know. Every single person that walked up in front of a Julianna Rancic mic, I'm like, I don't know who that is. Never seen that person before in my life. Don't know their music. Like, it was like I thought maybe I was being, I was just like one, maybe two. It was like seven in a row that I was like, I don't know who these people are. Luckily, my 9-year-old did. That's what you need. If you're having a hard time understanding current pop music and the stars that are making the music, get a 9-year-old.
That's the trick.
He was all over. He's like, oh, that's Alessia Bergara. And I'm like, I don't know who that is. Who is that? What did she sing? Oh, she sings Don't Worry, Everyone's Beautiful. All right, great. I didn't know that.
We had a little thing at our house where same thing. I'm like, oh, who is this? Never heard of this person. So I would look the person up. I'm like, oh, okay. Let me listen to a little bit of the song. And the song would start. I'm like, Uber. I heard it in the Uber car. Every Uber has that whatever song that was playing. Or the gym. That's a total gym song.
It's funny because I remember a stream of artists, and as new parents will know this because, you know, if you watch any of the sort of children's programming for Disney and Nickelodeon, they're sort of like the breeding ground for stars, for pop stars. So that's where you get a Miley Cyrus or a Selena Gomez. And it's funny because this now, I can't remember her name, I think it's Casey Ballerini. She's a country singer. And in the last 2 or 3 years, they've been really pushing her at Disney. And they push her, like, and they do the kind of fake videos where they're like commercials and 30-second video of her song. So when I see her up there for Best New Artist, I'm like, no. Like, right off the bat, I'm like, nope, no. She's in a bad sitcom on Disney. No.
Disqualified.
Disqualified. Get off the stage. Get out of there. It was funny because one of the songs that was up, the 7 Years song by Luke Graham, is that right? I can't remember. Anyway, I'm like, I don't know what this is. I have no idea. And my son, he's like, oh, I know that one. He goes, that's going to win. I go, why is it going to win? He goes, because my teacher sings it in class all the time. And I'm like, what? And he's like, once I was 7 years old. I was like, oh, yeah, I think I know that one. Way to go. He knows all the songs. Because I thought it was just a no-name. There's a lot of... I have a little bit of country bias when it comes to the Grammys. I don't listen to country music, so whenever you get to, like, the fourth person and it's like, you know, Jonathan Johnson, I'm like, I don't know who that is. He's got a cowboy hat. I don't know who that is. And my son knew all the artists.
He knows those too, yeah.
So there you go.
I was very excited to learn yesterday that Jason Derulo was black. I thought he was white all this time.
And one of the only artists in that Sweet Caroline spoof that they did who knew the words.
He did.
You know, he looked at the other people like, I don't know what to do, J-Lo and Faith Hill. Like, I don't know this song. And he's the one guy on the side going, touching hands, breaking hands.
I know. I was thinking, have you never been drunk at a bar?
This is the kind of bar you go to. Those guys are not drunk at our kind of bar.
Yeah, I guess
Neil Diamond's not. Neil Diamond, unless he's performing live. There's no Neil Diamond going in a cool Greenwich Village spot that J-Lo's hanging out at. Tonight, we've got a great show tonight. Bob Kester's going to join us, the longtime owner of the Jazz Record Mart, which closed 1 year ago this week. He has reopened the store up on Irving Park Road. We'll talk to him about his career, about jazz music, and about the a year since being at the Jazz Record Mart, which at the time was the largest jazz and blues emporium, if you will, in the world. So we'll talk with Bob Kester. Also tonight, author Irvine Welsh, the author of Trainspotting. And the characters from Trainspotting are what's creating Trainspotting 2. We'll talk to him about that. But he's also got a brand new project he's working on with another writer in Chicago, Don DeGrazio. So we'll talk with those two about their show, Creatives, which I've known that project for a while, and it's been several different iterations. It was a screenplay. I think it was a play. Now it's being presented as a rock opera. So we'll talk with Irvine Welsh on the show tonight. That's awesome. Also, My Gold Mask, live in studio tonight, Studio 435. Great band. Give you a little bit of dance pop tonight. Such an eclectic Studio 435. Every week is something different. Kudos to Pete Zimmerman for bringing the bands in, but My Gold Mask, tremendous band. And a little dance pop for you here on 720 WGN. And tonight, of course, Chris Varonis and Kevin Lampe are in for Roebling and Lundy. And we'll do Touche after the 7:30 news. So a lot to do tonight. News, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman. And this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got an outstanding show. We got a couple of them here. I got like back-to-back-to-back-to-back great shows coming up. Great guests. I'm very excited about this week, so let's get to it. We'll start this show with the carryout. This, of course, our nightly segment where I read the news, so you at home, you don't have to. Here are today's top stories after what was a promising week where Chicago hadn't seen a homicide in 60-plus hours. The weekend was a disaster. 27 people shot, including two girls, 11 and 12 years old. One of the girls was playing basketball in the park. The other was sitting in her mom's minivan outside a dry cleaner's. If there was one way that Chicago could undo 60-plus hours of violence-free living, well, they figured it out. That was it. Governor Rauner is reportedly going to address Chicago violence in his budget address on Wednesday. Sources say he's got an idea to create a new Illinois State Police Regiment, which would be 200 officers specifically trained to curb Chicago violence. Although it isn't clear if that's just to protect expressways in the Chicago area, as the governor mentioned in the State of the State, which I hope is not the case, because the optics are not great on that move. We got to protect the people coming to and from American Girl Place. But if you live in the areas affected by violence, there's nothing I can do. That's a miracle. Nothing I can do. That's what it feels like, right? It feels like that when you say we're going to protect these expressways because there's been shootings on the expressways. But there's shootings like every single weekend in bulk on the south and west sides. Today, Milwaukee residents took to protest over immigration and the uptick of ICE raids. Thousands of people marched. But according to ICE, and this is kind of the hard part for me, this has been kind of routine. During President Obama, deportations were at an all-time high, and it seems that if you compare months, the numbers, they're pretty standard. Now, you can argue that maybe that's the problem, that the American government, whoever runs it, is deportation happy. But is that what you're arguing? Or are you arguing that Trump is doing more because of his public stance against some forms of immigration? Essentially, do you not like the practice now because you don't like the new president? It's a fair question. Don't protest. Don't protest me. Don't break my bank window. A new muscular dystrophy drug is available in the United States after the FDA approved it. The drug, made by a Northbrook company, they want $89,000 a year from customers. Yep, $89,000. If you don't have insurance, they got coupons, so I wouldn't worry about it. $89K. This is where we want Donald Trump, right? Where's the tweet? Show him, Donnie! Nothing? How about a tweet about airline tickets being too expensive? They want $500 for a ticket to California this spring break. Donnie! Trump attack! Nothing. How about 12 bucks sandwich deals along Michigan Avenue? Nah? Well, at least he took down Nordstrom. I mean, their slacks, way too expensive. Way to go, Donnie. Oh, wait, that's about his daughter's clothing line. So I guess he's not the president of the people as we thought he was. Hopefully tomorrow. Tomorrow morning. Everybody look out for those muscular dystrophy tweets. Playboy is doubling back on their decision to remove nudity from their magazine. Nope. Turns out the publication can't live without the nudes. The centerfolds are going to return. So much for that whole dance about nobody does read the articles. Actually, this is great news for the out-of-work airbrushers of America. They didn't have any work for the last 2 years. They're like, oh, thank you. Thank you. Let's start with the hips. Billionaire Elon Musk is suggesting that the only way that humans adapt to the new digital culture surrounding us is to evolve with machines. Yep, we need to merge with the robots. Well, I was wondering when we'd get some good Valentine's Day stories in the news. So, I just think that we're really hitting it off.
Me too. I really think we are hitting it off.
What kind of music do you like?
I like all kinds of music with number 0011001.
Did you see the Grammys last night?
Yes, should have gone to Lemonade.
I could do that all night. Okay. All right, you get the idea. In the grossest news of the day, former Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky's son, Jeff Sandusky, was charged with sexual abuse of children. That's gross. And that's a hard pass, too. I have nothing to say about that. It's also saying a lot since there was a worm lawsuit filed against Popeyes today, and this was the grosser story. That's terrible. Apple shares hit an all-time high today. Analysts cite optimism for the iPhone 8. Wow, a phone that will probably be worth more than a grand. But how crazy. Highest stock price ever? Even more when they snuck that U2 album onto our iTunes without asking? I thought that was when it was the highest. Just think about how many mediocre albums they're going to sneak onto your iTunes now. They got nothing to lose. In weather, what a day, 45 degrees. But don't get too excited. This Wednesday is supposed to get down to 35 degrees. Might have to start a couple trash can fires. Ooh. Ooh. Also, say what you will about our weather, but at least we're getting it easy this year. At least we don't have to evacuate our town because a dam's about to break. What's that about? Jeez. In sports, the Northwestern Wildcats made their case for the first NCAA tournament berth with a win over 7th-ranked Wisconsin yesterday. This without Scotty Lindsey, their best player. On the road, no less. Not only is Northwestern one win away from their school record, which is 20 wins, but they are closing in on getting a top seed and a first-round bye in the Big Ten tournament. What? Who? Where? What? They got a huge game Wednesday at home against Maryland, who's currently ranked. We won't settle for fourth, guys. We want the whole tournament. I want the number one seed in March Madness. Right? Yesterday, last week, it was, I hope they make the tournament. Now, they got to be one of the number ones. And you could make an argument that they could, like, if it was Michigan State and they were, you know, ended up being like 22-6 and they won the actual Big Ten tournament, they get a number one seed. Don't pull that. We shouldn't expect for something less. I don't want to be in the business like, it's just great to be here. We're an eight seed. No. If they run the table and they actually go far in the Big Ten tournament, I expect a 3 or 4 seed. You heard it here first. Tomorrow, the pitchers and catchers report to Mesa, Arizona for the first Cubs spring training since they won in the World Series. No big deal. I'm going to say that all year. Wow, that's the first opening day since they won the World Series. That's the first Chris Bryant home run since they won the World Series. That's the first loss to the Reds since they won the World Series. And I'll just keep saying it till they win the next World Series in November. It's a good game. The Sox start spring training tomorrow, too, but eh. Actually, as a Sox fan, I feel way more excited about this season than the last few because the expectations have been set at the bare minimum. They're already been told it's a rebuild. We're already told they're not even going to win 30 games. So it can only go up, right? And frankly, that's how Sox fans like it. Give us the worst odds and watch us win a couple April series against the Tigers and the Indians. Then you could do the old June swoon, right? We'll accept it. Just right off the bat, I just want to hear one national ESPN guy go, "Oh, the White Sox surprising." Then we're done. We're done for the rough. Phone the rest of the season in. The Blackhawks have their bye week this week, of course, after winning five in a row. This is the first year the NHL is doing a bye week designed to give the players a break from the grueling regular season. It's good for the Hawks to get some rest, but probably tough on the guys selling fake neon Blackhawks balloons outside the UC. They're going to have to switch to some Ariana Grande bracelets or something like that this week. Tough week. And in women's college hoop tonight, UConn going for their 100th straight win against South Carolina. That's impressive. I mean, I won 50 straight games in Madden once, so I kind of know what it feels like. I think from one winner to another. Good luck. And finally tonight, a Texas woman is suing the Popeyes chain. She allegedly ordered a side dish and got screw worms. But not just any screw worm. They were Louisiana screw worms. That's so dumb. That was pretty dumb, wasn't it? That was great. I mean, all night I was working on that. Seriously, those worms will eat you from the inside out. That's the carryout for February 13th. Hey, still no snow, but if you're missing it, we got a special on snow cones with or without screw worms. All right, coming up, Kevin Lampe and Chris Varonis. Touche! They're in for Roebling and Lundy this week. Talk about all the things that are happening in the Trump White House. Also tonight, Bob Kester and author Irvine Welsh. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. All right. Rob Martier, how are you, my man? How was the weekend?
Not too bad. I heard you talking about Popeyes, and I guess someone found some screw worms in their side dish.
I've never heard of a screw worm in my life.
But you know what? Look, you take those nice little Cajun sprinkles that they give you. You sprinkle those on anything, and you're golden.
I think they proved that, right?
Absolutely. I love Popeyes. I do.
Yeah, it seems to be all a big thing in Texas, so it's not nationwide. It's just specific to one, I think, San Antonio restaurant. So you're cool. If you're in Chicago eating Popeyes tonight, you actually have a piece of chicken in your mouth. We're sorry.
I've got a couple up by me, man. They know my name. Standing orders.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touché.
You go right. Yes, it's time for Touche. Monday nights here on the Download 720. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, in replace of Dave Lundy and Chris Roebling, the White House was just like, Roebling and Lundy, they gotta go. No, they're just it's like Trump is running who's on the program. No, in tonight, Chris Varonis and Kevin Lampe, ready to spar tonight based on the news of the week. I gotta say, the weekends are just becoming as important as the weeks. I mean, what we saw this weekend with both the story with Michael Flynn in Russia, but also what happened with the testing of ballistic missiles in North Korea and the strange, almost absurdist sort of display that was on was at the terrace at Mar-a-Lago. It just feels like weekends are becoming much more salacious than the weeks.
How exciting to be at Mar-a-Lago for dinner and be able to Snapchat an international incident.
It really felt that way. I mean, I don't know if this is, again, we've talked about it on this program, if it's just, you know, this is going to be a new White House with a new way that a business, and it's not that big of a deal that he was having, international conversations in public. I mean, is this a story? Is it overblown by the media, or is there something to the fact that, you know, there was business being done in view of people at a country club?
Probably a little awkward. You'd want to pick up whatever the situation is, whatever the gravity is, and take it inside. The prime minister didn't, have an inclination to do that. It could be overblown. I there's also this piece that whatever Trump does, no one's going to give him an inch. So, I mean, there's that piece of it, too.
I think the real problem was, that Trump wanted to charge Trump for an extra banquet room in order to go have a meeting. And so instead, well, let's just do this national security thing here, and let's put out all the papers, and then everybody can Snapchat it, and somebody will Facebook Live it, and then we can everybody can participate.
That is funny. He saved the American government some money by not using another.
Looking at those prices, probably a $12,000 rental fee. What AV has got to be at least $15,000-$30,000.
Well, let's talk about depressing stories today. That story seems to be that's so Sunday. Let's talk about today a lot about Michael Flynn and his relationship with Russia. Obviously, there was a call that was made that has been in the news for a couple weeks now. Based at first, he denied talking about sanctions, the sanctions that the Obama administration had put on Russians. Now, you know, intelligence officers have come out and said, we taped those calls, man. We I hate to tell you, but you should know that you're always
really
observed. It really does. And they're saying, no, you did talk about it. Mike Pence is involved because the vice president came out in support of Michael Flynn. What do we make here? Are we on the verge of Donald Trump's first firing?
Yeah, I think we are. And I think this isn't going to be the only one. I think the bullseye is on a few people, including Rance Priebus. Flynn could be the first one to go in the next couple of weeks. What he did was very serious. He not only lied to the vice president, but he lied to the nation, too. He's also, I think, out of all of them, the most unhinged out of all the cabinet picks. I mean, of course, Kevin thinks the entire cabinet's like the Manson family. But
not the Manson family. More, right.
You don't want to insult the Manson family, right? So, but he's likely to go out. It's probably a good thing. And you want people like Mattis and Tillerson in there who know what they're doing, who've got policy experience, who know who they are, quite frankly. Those are the people that need to be driving policy.
Kevin, from the Democratic
side.
It's
like they're the hall monitors. But, poor Flynn, it's announced today, Kellyanne announced as well, the president's fully confident in Flynn, which is exactly what a university president says the night before they fire the head football coach.
Right.
You know, the only thing missing was that. The only thing missing about that is 100% confident.
Right.
You know, 120%, 140%. You're gone by Tuesday.
Let me ask you this question. I mean, is Michael Flynn is he the guy, if Trump goes ahead and replaces him, let's say quickly, does the Russian controversy over Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin, does it go away?
No. The Russian stuff is not going away. Flynn is toast. He'll be gone by the end of the week. And then we'll see what the next piece of bread comes up that's going to get toasted. And it is going to be a challenge. You know, they're going to pet somebody in, but the Russian stuff is not going away. It's too interesting. There's a great villain.
There's a great villain, and the congressional Republicans want an investigation. And quite frankly, we should.
I feel sorry. You know, when has it been that the Republicans are defending the dictator of Russia? How did that happen?
Kevin. A little credit is in order.
Okay,
here.
All right. The autocrat ruler of Russia.
You've got McConnell and Ryan, and you've got key committee heads of jurisdiction saying, we should do this. We should absolutely investigate.
Yes, and they're whispering it very softly, but we're not really going to talk about it much. We're going to let the president talk about it, and we're going to stay out of the way because we'll get it with shrapnel.
But, there has been some criticism that Republicans at some point in Congress, they need to stand up to some of the chaos that's happening around the Trump administration. Do you see them sort of getting in line and staying behind the president, or are you going to start to see splinter kind of situations like Russia where they go, like what we saw with John McCain last week, where he's just like, hey, listen.
They're going to support the president when it produces good policy, tax reform, the repeal of Obamacare. And when Trump has an eruption, they're just going to sit back and let it happen.
You think so? Yeah.
That's how I see this playing out. It's going to be hard to play that game. But
Kevin, let me ask you about the Democrats, because we've seen them lose a very high profile. Now, they will say, hey, it was unprecedented that Vice President Mike Pence had to cast a vote for Betsy DeVos. But at the end of the day, the Democrats lost. They put everything in. They tried to filibuster everything, and they lost that fight. Do the Democrats right now, do they feel like off of this Trump chaos that's happening in the first couple weeks, do they feel like they're getting their footing?
They need to. Well, as a Democrat, we need to understand what the role of the party of the opposition. And there is a role. In government around the world, the party of opposition is the party that needs to speak up. And the Democrats are learning on who's going to be the best spokesperson. Elizabeth Warren has done an amazing job. The way women rose up on the persistent line, it was as if we gave that line to Mitch McConnell. and wrote it. You know, I would love to have offered that line, you know, particularly because all the T-shirt sales that you're going to get from all the persistent T-shirts. But the Democrats are learning their way, and you're going to see some people start to emerge. You're going to see some people in Congress. You're going to see some governors, you know, who are going to start to take a look at what they can do and what they and look at their own ability to kind of grab that national stage.
Yeah,
see, I'd be concerned. I mean, you're looking at this DNC chair selection. What a mess! It's like everyone's in denial.
What's a mess that a lot of people are running for?
No one wants to do straight talk and say we screwed up.
You obviously have not been listening to the people who are talking.
Who's talking? Who's saying?
Chris
that,
Ellison
Kevin?
Is saying we made a mistake. People are talking about the fact we did this wrong. You know, I've listened and I've talked to these people.
You heard him on the Sunday shows.
He is talking about the problem, the things that Democrats need to do to fix it.
I heard we need to retool our message. And when I hear that, I just roll my eyes and I'm like, well, Republicans are going to have another run at it for the next 4 years.
Well, let's start. Let's take a quick break. Chris Varonis and Kevin Lampe in studio tonight, filling in for Roebling and Lundy on Touche. We come back. We got to talk immigration. The sort of ICE raids that have happened over the weekend have brought, and of course, what happened with the courts and the response from the Trump administration, including a strange Sunday morning talk show run with Stephen Miller, one of the White House advisors. We'll talk all about that coming up here on Touche. Stay with us.
I just said that.
I know you just said that.
Okay, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
Well, I'm not sure where you're going with this.
That's what I just said.
That's what I'm saying to you.
All right.
Touche.
All right, Chris Varonis, Kevin Lampe in studio. We are in the midst of our Monday segment, Touche, in for Roebling and Lundy this week. All right, so let's get, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. One, I kind of mentioned right at the end about immigration, but let's start with Stephen Miller, who was the spokesperson that was chosen by the Trump administration for the Sunday morning talk shows. He did, it felt like 7 or 8 interviews across the board, and he was, I mean, just panned. Across the board, everyone did not like his demeanor. They didn't like what he had to say. He didn't do well. There's so many jokes going around about him. But again, is it something that anyone cares about except for the sort of, you know, the belt?
The beltway. Yeah, I think what's going on here, unfortunately, is Donald Trump is involved too much in the day to day operations of the White House, where he's watching Sunday morning programs. Saturday Night Live, and making policy as a result of it. So what I personally think is he's in search of the right spokesman with the right hard edge. And to yesterday, they landed on Stephen Miller. I tend to agree with some of the comments that have been out there that what he was saying was forget judicial review, for example.
You know,
that the courts have the final say. But I think optically, too, there's a sinking feeling that happens in people when they see that.
You know,
he's a young guy. He's 31 years old.
You know, and it's like, you know, every time I hear his name, all I hear in my head is my vinyl album singing, you know, Jokers to the left of me, fools to the right. Here I am stuck in the middle with you.
That wasn't the Steve Miller band, but
and,
go ahead.
Hopefully
your policy calls are better.
That's what I hear. But the challenge is you have to look like the spokesperson.
Right.
And, you know, when I send my clients out into the world, you know, your messenger has to be acceptable to the mind's eye and to the eye of the viewer. And they have to look at them and go, okay, I trust you. I believe you. I know what you're going to say.
The spokesman should be persuasive. You know, like if they could have a guy like Jim Baker with like a southern drawl and, you know, that's the kind of bedside manner they need. But they'll never ever select.
I look at Steve, and all I see is Peter Sellers and Dr. Strangelove, you know, trying to hold his arm down.
You said that about Steve Bannon. How many people are trying to hold back their right arm, Kevin?
Well, that's a good question for the White House. Yeah, that's a good question for the White House there. But the challenge is they don't know what they're doing yet. And Trump is used to being a CEO who says things and people jump and everybody does it.
Yeah.
And that's just not how
it
works.
Never had a boss.
Ronner is used to that. Well, I think he had a terrible boss at home. It's like daddy issues just got to be coming out.
Well, let me ask you about the president. I'm fascinated about whether or not, you know, because there's so many pieces that have come out and thought pieces, Sunday pieces in the New York Times about what kind of White House it is, leaks abound, him walking around lonely, this, that, and the other. You know, is this the kind of
–
yeah, the bathrobe. But is this the kind of thing that ruffles his feathers, the idea that every time he has it's at Mar-a-Lago and now everyone's questioning what he's doing, or, you know, Stephen Miller in the way that, you know, this wasn't the right – does he not care?
The leaks are serious. There are an incredible amount of leaks that are going on right now. You have to think it's creating a paranoia. There is even a story that intelligence operatives are looking at the handheld devices and the computers of some of the inner circle. So people are looking over their backs. People are freaking out. But people are also, going against the president. He's looking at that as betrayal. Yeah. So it is real.
Yeah.
It is real what's...
And to be leaking like they are, leaking like a sieve, that just, you know, I've dealt this and I've helped people deal with leaks in their own political offices. And you don't know who you trust, and you don't know, you know why they're doing it, because they want to win favor or get the next job up the ladder. But you're in the White House, man. You know, you can't go much higher than that. So why are you leaking? Do you want to be the one that takes down your boss?
Well, leaks happen in every White House, but these leaks are especially concerning.
Okay, so let's talk about some of the policy. You know, we saw with the travel ban and the court decision last week, and this is a lot what Stephen Miller was talking about, the fact that, you know, there should be unquestioned presidential power in this situation. But what we've seen is that there's been a hold. There's a pause to say, and this is sort of a thought that perhaps the White House is going to rewrite the executive order. Instead of pressing ahead and trying to go to the Supreme Court with this decision, they may say, hold up, we're just going to rewrite it so it's more legal. Yeah. I mean, do you see that happening? Is this something that you see the Trump administration actually conforming to?
They've got no choice. Politically, they have to slow walk this. Trump, another bee in Trump's bonnet is the rollout of this order, which was sloppy, and he blames his staff on it. And everyone believes that now, not even Republicans. They need to slow walk it and presumably get Gorsuch in there. Because they can't afford the humiliation of taking this to the court and have a 4-4, which is essentially no policy.
Right. I mean, do Democrats recognize that there might possibly be a way that he rewrites it and this may be a slow walk, Chris said, and they're waiting for a new judge?
Oh, absolutely. You know, that's the logical thing to do. The problem is they don't do anything logically. But the wise course for them is to write it carefully and then roll it out carefully. But, you know, Trump is used to running things where if it doesn't turn out well, I'm going to tell everybody it's okay and I'm still going to be able to sell condos. But now he has policy, which he doesn't really know how to sell. And he needs to learn how to sell ideas as opposed to being able to sell a piece of property. Hmm. With the piece of property, you can put up some stucco and you can cover up the mistakes. Here, you can't. You can't just, you know, put some molding around bad policy.
I mean, there is something to be said. Both of you guys have worked in government, or at least with consulting with government. There is a lot of government is ideas, or politics are ideas that you have to persuade people over. And maybe that's something that is new to this administration, to Trump, who hasn't had to persuade as much as sell.
Right.
And it's a big difference. I sold radio advertising when I first got out of college. It's, you know, you're selling air.
I mean, he did a great job of persuading the American people to vote for him. So he is charming in the sense that he knows that, you know, he gets up on stage every night and he's in front of arenas full of people. So, I mean, he does have that charm.
That may be part of the problem with Trump in that he hasn't stopped campaigning. There's no bright line between the campaign and governance. He thinks what worked in the campaign should work for the next 4 years. And I think that's going to come back to bite.
And this is the sort of taking on even what we saw with Elizabeth Warren, bringing back the Pocahontas Barb, some of the things that he said to, you know,
Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, this concept that he is continuing to play the games that he played in the campaign.
Because he was good at that. That was his strength. That's what got him to the office. The challenge is, though, one of the hardest things about being a president is the briefings. And is sitting there and going through page by page by page by page. And I've briefed presidents and presidential candidates in my career. And the ones that ask the most questions, the ones that take the time to read every word and understand and then ask tough questions, they're in a better position to explain their policy and believe in their policy.
Do you think, I mean, I think about the protests today in Milwaukee. It was really about the ICE raids and what's happening in immigration. There's some that you read the thought pieces that say that the immigration and deportations that are happening with ICE are standard, that this is what Obama did as well.
Absolutely.
Do you think that the news and the and just the way that it's playing out, even from the opposition, do you think that everyone is I don't want to be so Pollyanna about it, but being unfair to the president? I mean, this seems to be an American government issue more than a President Trump
issue.
Well,
I will, you know, having some original source, you know, I'm working on a huge political asylum case right now. I'm working with a number of immigration lawyers. I've been out at O'Hare working with the immigration lawyers out there. They are shocked at the intensity and the home raids now that are going on by ICE, not just workplaces, but going from house to house in neighborhoods looking for undocumented workers. This is not precedent as far as the immigration community is concerned.
Do you know what this really is? It's the Democrats and the left wing not wanting to normalize Trump. That's all this is.
No.
It just happens to manifest itself in immigration. Now, I'll tell you, Kevin, I'm one of those Republicans who happens to be for immigration reform. But at the same time, and I do think the policy morally was not a good thing. But at the same time, Obama, the deporter in chief. That's who he was.
Yes.
Yeah.
Chris Varonis, Kevin Lampe, Touche. Thanks, guys, for filling in tonight here for Roebling and Lundy. We'll be back on Monday. Guys, thanks so much.
Our pleasure.
You know, we hit on something there with Chris and Kevin just at the end about whether or not, you know, this is, you know, when it comes to the raids, when it comes to immigration, to deportations, whether or not this is more active and more intense when the Trump administration than the Obama administration. And that's been the hardest thing for me to figure out when reading stories in the New York Times or Chicago Tribune or online when you're watching TV. It's really hard to understand if it's just a continuing practice that we all want to look at, or if it's something that has been ratcheted up. And that, I just don't have the answer to that.
2009 to 2015, 2.5 million
right.
illegal immigrants
right.
deported by President Obama, who was basically just doing his job.
Absolutely. That's the thing. And I think Chris makes a good point when he says this is liberals' way of not wanting to normalize Trump. You want to create like he's the Gestapo and they're knocking down doors, and this is something that has never been done in American history. But I just, you know, just reading the facts like you just said, I mean, the last 6 years have been tremendous when it comes to deportation.
I also question when people use the word an increased intensity of the deportations.
Right. What does that
mean? Well, first of all, how are we to gauge that? And if you were an immigrant that's about to be deported, I think it's a pretty intense situation to begin with.
I read a there's a couple of great pieces online. One about what happens, and this I read over the weekend. One, what happens when people are rounded up and where they go? They go to private prisons. After that, if they're deported, they go right off if they're Mexican, they go to the Mexican border. And there's a whole cottage industry that has been created to essentially manipulate and take advantage of those people who are left, you know, right on the other side of the border, hundreds of miles from home, other which way. They're just waiting for them. I mean, it's a fascinating read. I don't know where I saw it, but if you look at just, you know, the idea of the plight of someone who's deported. But then I also read today just about how many, you know, how this may just be standard in an American operating procedure. So I'd like to see more written on this from reporters to get a better sense of whether or not this is something that, you know, is worth, you know, a protest of Trump or a protest, if you don't believe in it, in America. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, it's hard to believe it's almost been a year since my next guest sold the Jazz Record Mart. The store was the largest jazz and blues record store in the world right here in Streeterville. But like many great institutions in this city, the store succumbed to high rents. But that didn't stop my next guest, Bob Kester, from staying in the business. Kester is the man behind the Chicago jazz label Delmark. And since this past fall, also the owner and operator of Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart, on the northwest side of Chicago, 3419 West Irving Park Road, to be exact. Bob sold off all the records and some of the memorabilia from the old jazz record shop, but that hasn't stopped him from collecting new records, new memorabilia. Not bad for a man who just turned 84 years young, a true Chicago treasure. Bob Kester is my guest tonight at the big table. Bob, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Well, I enjoyed being here.
Let's talk about the new store. Because, you know, when the Jazz Record Mart was gone, I mean, you had talked about maybe just doing the record label. What brought you back to doing retail?
Well, people kept selling me record collections. And we did some business from the front room of the Delmark building, which happily we own, so there was no rent involved.
Right, right. How much of what's at Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart on the Northwest Side is similar to what you were doing at the Jazz Record Mart right here? And even before that, the one that was on Grand.
Well, it's totally, you know, we have a little less space, but we're really crowded with stuff. I've been so busy buying record collections, CDs and LPs and a 178 collection, that we're just not finished setting up. And I spend my full time, 6 days a week, 10:30 to 6:30 p.m., I'm in the store, pricing goods and filing them and trying to figure out how to get everything crammed in there. Like one collection was 3,600 CDs, wow, all straight ahead modern jazz, no vocals.
Where do you get these collections? People just collect them and they're like, well, I want to get rid of them, I'll call Bob?
Sadly, it's often a death of somebody. In this case, the 3,600, the father, I believe, died and left a collection, and she brought in all the instrumental stuff. I think she thought maybe the vocal stuff wouldn't be interesting to us, but she'll be bringing that in. And she brought only CDs, I guess thinking the LP was obsolete something. But, hell, I still sell 78s.
And people are...
I've got one Edison record in there, one of those thick Edison records.
What are you looking for when someone comes in with a collection or gets a hold of you and contacts you saying, I've got jazz CDs, is there something specific that you're looking for all the years that you've been in the business?
I'm looking only for jazz and blues. If it's not blues or jazz and we somehow acquire it, we have a 99-cent section where you can get some pretty well-known rock artists and the mood music stuff that isn't jazz, some of it is. Anything that isn't jazz goes in there. And we have some people who come and they aren't into jazz, but they like their 99-cent stuff.
Well,
of course, there's jazz in there, too.
Is there a certain style of jazz that you've is a better seller than others? I mean, when bringing their collection in and it's modern jazz with just instrumentals, are people interested in that kind of stuff?
Well, modern jazz, which, of course, is a half century old now, more than that. Modern jazz is what most of our customers want. Some are also into avant-garde. Not enough are into trad. And I think it's because a lot of the traddies live in the suburb and we're not that easy to get to. But the parking isn't $4 an hour like it was downtown.
You're circling the block trying to get to your store,
right? You can
right.
park on a side street for nothing.
Right.
You know? Like I say, it's not a great location, but the rent is cool, and it's near my house.
I ask you the question, and respectfully, but why not? Why get into the retail business again? Why not walk away and just do the record label and have a retirement of sort?
Income. We're not back to the kind of volume we did at the Jazz Record Mart, but I don't need to be. We found a space. We looked a lot of different spaces, and this one was not only pretty reasonable rent. Next door for a similar space, they went down there more than twice as much money. And it's not at all finished. The place we're in now had a great floor. There was a floor company in there before.
That's good.
And the floor is just so, the front room is just beautiful. We got three rooms. You walk in and it's jazz LPs. You step into the back room on the left is CDs, jazz CDs. You take a right turn into a room with some windows, and it's all blues, 45, 78s, so forth. Way in the back, we got 78s. And in the back, there is enough space around the 78s that we have music there. We're going to start having films or music every Saturday at 1 or 2 o'clock. We have had some already. One of my hobbies, see, I was going to be a filmmaker who collects records. Instead, I'm a record maker who collects films. And I'm glad because I don't have to live in Los Angeles.
Well, let me do this. Let me take a quick break and to stay on time tonight. And,
sure.
But I want to talk to you about coming to Chicago, Del Mar, your experience in coming up through jazz.
Sure.
And Bob Kester, the Chicago treasure, Chicago legend, the man behind the Chicago Jazz Mart, or the Jazz Record Mart, over here, which was on Wabash, but also then again on Grand and Wabash, now up at 3419 West Irving Park Road. That's Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. More with Bob. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest, Bob Kester, in studio, the legendary jazz label owner, Jazz Record Mart owner. You've done so much for the jazz community here in Chicago.
I don't own jazz. Jazz owns me.
There it is, right? You got the new store, Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart, up in the northwest side, 3419 West Irving Park Road. Really the same concept of what was down here at the Jazz Record Mart in Streeterville.
Right.
But let's talk about coming to Chicago. You came to Chicago in the late 50s. Talk about why you came here and what about jazz music attracted you.
I got a letter from a man named John Steiner. He taught chemistry at U of I. I'm getting ready to retire. I'd like to sell you my Paramount properties. Paramount was a label, as you probably know, in the 20s, did a lot of more recording of blues than any other label at the time. And that was interesting to me because my record company had begun to happen. Del Mar, named after Del Mar Boulevard, which was the street where all the jazz clubs were in St. Louis back then. And John loaned me the money to buy Seymour's Record Mart in the Roosevelt U Auditorium building. It wasn't much money because Seymour had his LPs there on consignment from a one-stop wholesaler. So I wasn't buying those. And it's just as well because a lot of them weren't jazz. So I got fixtures, a cash register, a showcase, a glass showcase, which I still have. It's in the front room at Del Mar. We keep our trophies there. And that set me up. We thought it was a pretty dead store, but business was quite good.
I mean, I was going to say, I mean, this is the 60s. So, I mean, early 60s, late 50s, early 60s.
Yeah.
I mean, jazz music in Chicago, this was happening, jazz and blues. Yeah. There was a market. This was known as a jazz and blues town.
Well, Seymour's was better known than I had thought it had been. There was a guy named Joe Siegel.
Of course.
Had worked there a lot. And he came back to work. And he pretty much did the buying of modern jazz. Because my own taste and the extent of my merchandising was all in the traditional jazz realm. Still my favorite.
When you say traditional jazz to our listeners, that's stuff from the 20s and
30s? I hate the word Dixieland, but it pretty well covers it. It covers a lot of garbage, too. But I was into blues, but there was no market for blues. So Paramount didn't seem that interesting to me because Riverside Records had already licensed from Steiner the right to issue, and they had covered... I had a couple of Blind Lemon Jefferson records, a couple of Ma Rainey LPs, all the jazz that was on Paramount. They had also done a deal for Jeanette Records, so that gave them a really great catalog. So I was less interested in Paramount, but it was a reason to come to Chicago.
When you got to Chicago and it became Del Mar, what kind of artists, what kind of music did you want to produce on the label?
Well, at that time, traditional jazz. And the first sessions I did here were Albert Nicholas, a New Orleans clarinetist who had moved to France, came over. We did a quartet record with Art Hodes and a full band record with Albert.
But that's what you were going for, was that quote-unquote Dixieland kind of music.
That was the type of music that I preferred, and still is my favorite stuff.
How did Chicago when you think about coming to Chicago and starting up and bringing that kind of music, which is already prominent here, but how did the audience and the consumers react to that kind of music, you having Dixieland artists on your label?
Well, there were a lot of good traditional jazz artists here. Art Hodes, the great pianist and organizer and one-time publisher of a really great magazine. George Brunis lived here. And there were a lot of guys like Norman Murphy, younger guys who played the early type of music. There were clubs like Jazz Limited, which is down the street from where the store was on Grand Avenue. There was a place where Brunis worked. There was a club called the 1111. And it was a thriving trad scene. But I had begun to broaden my listening when I was in St. Louis. I went one day to a place called The Barrel, paid 50 cents for a beer, which I didn't like beer back in those days. Well, it was Schlitz, Budweiser, but beers I still don't like. I like the German beer. The German beer is what turned me on to beer. I would pay 50 cents, and at The Barrel, Miles Davis, for two sets, no cover, no minimum, 50 cents. I didn't go that often because I wasn't that into it. But we recently issued a record that I taped at The Barrel with an old Riverboat trumpet player named Dewey Jackson with some Chicago talent. That's a different story. I could probably talk about that for quite a while. I could bore the heck out of it.
I know, but I mean, I think that the time that you started Delmark, that this concept of there being a change in jazz music, where you had the traditional jazz music up to that point, and then you mentioned Miles Davis, and you mentioned John Coltrane, and others who started to usher in the era of modern jazz. Yeah. As a record label owner at that time, did you feel that wave? Did you feel that the music was changing?
Well, before I left St. Louis, I discovered a guitar player named Grant Green, and I wanted to record him. So when Harry Edison came to the Blue Note here with Jimmy Forrest and a good rhythm section, we recorded Jimmy with Grant Green, and he signed from an R&B date for VJ. This was the first time Grant Green recorded, and we got two albums out of that. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, with Joe Siegel's help, we recorded Ira Sullivan with Johnny Griffin, and another Ira Sullivan with Nicky Hill, who was a really marvelous sax player who died not long after our recordings. He had done almost no other recording. And I was gradually getting my head into the modern stuff.
Yeah.
Like I say, in St. Louis, I wanted to record Grant Green and Jimmy Forrest. Well, Jimmy went to New York, joined Harry Edison's band, came back to Chicago, and we finally did it.
You know, for you, the label and what you did with Delmark is at the same track as Jazz Record Mart. I mean, down on Roosevelt University, but also then up here at Grand and State, and then over at Streeterville. I mean, the idea that you were present to watch jazz music explode, to be the music that people wanted here in Chicago, and you also ultimately watched it decline in the way that the more and more people, it became a niche kind of art that people came in, and there was a loyalty that came to the store, but not necessarily mainstream appeal. Let's talk about that. Why don't I take a break and get the update on tonight's news? But when we come back, Bob, I want to talk about that because it feels like you almost can be a jazz consumer historian for us in the way that you've seen the music change over the years. Bob Kester, my guest, Chicago legend, the former owner of the Jazz Record Mart, now the owner of Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart on the Northwest Side, 3419 West Irving Park Road, to be exact. We'll have more with Bob Kester here at the Big Table after the news. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Bob Kester, Chicago legend, the man who owned the Jazz Record Mart right here at Wabash in Illinois for years. Got great stories going in there. Before that, it was at Grand and State. Now it is called Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart on the Northwest Side, 3419 West Irving Park Road. Bob still continues to run his jazz label, Delmark. Before the news, we're talking about just the way that jazz, you've been there for all the generations of jazz. You saw it explode, and I would think this would be the 60s and 70s where Chicagoans couldn't get mm-hmm. enough of the art form. And you also were around to watch as the popularity of this art form declined. Let's start with the heyday. Where would you say the heyday of jazz consumerism was?
Well, I think it's still happening. I mean, jazz is spreading all over the world. It's not doing all that well in the United States, but it never has. It never
really?
Has. The only time jazz was the popular music was the late 30s and very early 40s, the swing era, the big bands. And that was a time when combo jazz was a rarity. Benny Goodman's sextet, mostly guys who were in the band, playing between sets. Teddy Wilson, black guy, brought in to play between sets. Jess Stacy in the regular band, that sort of thing. Combo jazz, when Muggsy Spanier signed with Bluebird Records in 1939, that was it. That's traditional jazz, real hardcore trad. And damn good stuff.
When I think of jazz music, I think of a late 50s, mid-60s experience. I think of Blue Note Records mm-hmm. in New York City.
Yeah.
And I think
great
of
label.
Miles Davis and John, and Coltrane. All the people who were almost bringing jazz to a new level of cool, if you will.
Yeah.
What was happening in Chicago at that time? When you had all these artists that were becoming, infamous, not just famous, but legendary. What was happening? What continued to make Chicago a jazz town?
Joe Siegel. Various clubs.
Jazz Showcase, right.
He did Monday night concerts at the Gato Horn, and whatever great jazz, modern jazz artists were in town would always show up, whether they had been advertised or not. It was not to miss. And those Monday nights really got my head into modern jazz. But the big change at Del Mar was the AACM, the Association for Advancement of Creative Musicians, Southside, and largely composed of avant-garde. But it was Roscoe Mitchell, Joseph Jarman, Anthony Braxton, Richard Abrams. And I was being advised by people who weren't that into that music that I gotta record Roscoe Mitchell, Don DeMichael, straight-ahead modern jazz drummer and the editor of Downbeat. You got to record Roscoe Mitchell.
And this was a different style of jazz than had ever sort of been seen before.
This was avant-garde.
I mean, this is avant-garde, right?
The new music. And Archie Shepp had recorded for Contemporary Records. ESP Records started with... Sun Ra belonged in that, and he started recording. We have his first records made in the 50s, his first and second record that he made for a Boston label whose masters Blue Note didn't buy. They bought most of the masters, the Cecil Taylor and most of the Donald Byrds. We got a Donald Byrd with Yusuf and two Sun Ra records. And everything Sun Ra did after that, except for some ESPs, is... quite a few albums on a label. Everybody thinks Sun Ra owns it. It's actually his manager owned it. But this got Del Mar into the avant-garde, and I think it's the most important recordings we've ever done.
And really something that is indigenous in a way to Chicago. Mm-hmm. Chicago brought these musicians were bringing music that had never been heard before to the forefront.
Avant-garde was happening coast to coast. It was the big movement, big change in jazz. And I don't think there's been that much change since then. There's been some straight-ahead buyers, but most of the newly arrived and great jazz musicians have been in the avant-garde.
You know, I asked Ramsey Lewis this when he was here, the same question about why do you think that jazz has not flourished in America the way it has in Europe? What is it about American audiences or American musicians or just the palate of American consumers that is different than people in Europe?
One reason is payola, which has been legalized now. Radio stations can charge record companies to play the records, but this is widespread.
We won't tell them how much you paid me to have this interview.
I didn't pay it.
No money.
I am too cheap. But payola tells Americans what they should listen to. And there are a lot of other kinds of music, country music, rhythm and blues, different areas of the country, polka music. Mm-hmm. We're a multinational country, you know. We have music from all over the world, and some of it's pretty great stuff, even if it isn't jazz or blues.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we'll talk to different jazz musicians who will say they do something in a tour in America, and they have a hard time selling out the clubs, and or you know, they're not billed in the same way. And then they go to Germany, and they're screaming fans. There's thousands of people that wanted to check out someone that American audiences haven't even heard of.
We're losing artists. Guy goes to France. Blues piano players here had trouble getting gigs. So Memphis Slim, Jack Dupree, Curtis Gill, and several other blues piano players went there because the pianos were in tune, and there were pianos. They'd go to a Chicago blues bar, yeah. They damn near never have pianos. So we've lost the blues piano, and that's a shame because piano's been around blues since the get-go.
Yeah. For blues and jazz artists, are you encouraged or dismayed that at the number of jazz and blues artists that are coming up in a new generation, younger musicians? Are they choosing this art form to be musically?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you got a bunch of young kids, and they're fairly creative. They're teaching jazz in the colleges. Being taught music no longer means being prejudiced against jazz, which was the case for many years.
Why was there a prejudice against jazz?
Well,
where's that come from?
Black music.
Because it was black, because it was African American music.
Yeah. Jazz has always been very much black music. Most of the, you get a guy like Big Spider back once in a while or a Pee Wee Russell, but most of the most creative artists have been black. And jazz has been part of the integration process in this country. You have Benny Goodman hiring Teddy Wilson and Charlie Christian. Stan Kenton even had one or two black musicians in his band, and you couldn't play whiter jazz than Stan Kenton, I don't think. Nice guy, I met him once, but it was amazing how many Stan Kenton 78s we had at the store. But that's about as white as jazz ever got, I think.
Do you miss the jazz record, Mart? Do you miss the being downtown, being part of
I'd like
Chicago?
To see more people come to the store, but they're gradually finding out. I was amazed how hip the neighborhood is.
Where you're at, Albany
that
Park,
helped.
Avondale kind of
that
area.
Helped
yeah.
a lot.
Who was coming to the Jazz Record Mart in 2015? Who was your customer? Is it people
from all over the South Side, the North Side, and the West Side? We don't hear much from the East Side. They're out there in the lake boating around.
They can't take a break.
Not into the music.
You weren't that far from the river, so you think could have just jumped up. Is it a loyal audience, meaning an audience that's very into this type of music, and they go, "I got to go to Jazz Record Mart," or is it more of a browse type audience? It's like, well, I'm going to go into this store and see what mm-hmm. I can find.
Before we had the Delmark Building on Rockwell, we had a two-story building on Lincoln, across from the supermarket yeah. there. We lived upstairs, and I had Delmark downstairs. Briefly, I had a second Jazz Record Mart. But when we moved from 7 West Grand, which was 500 or 600 square feet, to 3,000 square feet, I needed the inventory and the fixtures downtown. But the sign stayed there. And we had people say, long after we closed, we'd have people go, "Oh, I go to your other store all the time."
Because they see the sign.
Yes. We still get that. They think there's a store there. In fact, they sent the sign out to be painted, and there's a little place where the Jazz Record Mart had chipped off, and the wallpaper store, part of the wallpaper sign is in there, and they painted that over, too. That's the alderman's office now.
You said a little bit earlier in the hour, you said, you don't own jazz, jazz owns you. What does that
jazz
mean?
Jazz and blues. Well, they captured me. They deterred me from having to live in Los Angeles and being a cameraman. Two of my brothers are. One's in the union, one's not. So they're doing what I didn't have to do, but they have to live in L.A. So that's their punishment for imitating their brother.
I mean, you spent just decades of your life in jazz music, whether recording artists and working at the label Delmark, or, of course, being behind the cash register at the Jazz Record Mart. You know, as you think about your life and the fact that it's been decades, I mean, we're talking, what, 5 or 6 decades now of immersing yourself in jazz music. Would you have it any other way?
No, I'm quite happy with what happened in my life. I've got a good wife. I've got a couple of good kids. And, I'm thrilled. I mean, I get to live in one of the great cities. Chicago, I love Chicago. I've become very, very fond of this city. Not much to dislike the weather this time of year. Right. It's better in L.A. But my mother lived in Santa Barbara, and she used to come to Chicago in the middle of winter to enjoy some winter because we're from Wichita, Kansas, you know, which the weather is some of the best entertainment there, you know.
That's right. You got to have a little bit of the change of the seasons. Bob Kester is the longtime owner of Delmark Records. He also is the owner and operator of Bob's Blues and Jazz Mart on the northwest side, 3419 West Irving Park Road. Bob, Chicago Treasure, thanks for joining us at Big Table. We appreciate
it. It's been a pleasure to run my mouth.
Good combo with Bob Kester there. I feel like he nailed it on the idea that popular music these days is just straight up payola. You know, I don't know. I'd love to get somebody. We should see if Abraham will come back. You know, we were doing the Nerds on Tour segment, and he might be able to answer this question. I want to know if the rules and the laws that regulate what was regulated back in the Dick Clark days of, you know, you can't take money to play an album, if that's long gone. You know, have they found different ways to make Ariana Grande just a product? And, you know, it just feels to me, and this is that sort of, you know, conspiracy theorist in myself, that feels like the radio station, the record company, the artist, everything is all one. And it just is this circular kind of thing that, you know, plays out on your radio. And when I listen to it, or more importantly, when my 9-year-old son listens to it, and he says, oh, this Ed Sheeran, he's so good. And I'm like, yeah, he is good. He wouldn't be at this level if he wasn't so good. But why am I hearing his song every 3 minutes? Why do I, you know, every time he has an album out, we are on this program, we have millions, it feels like, in 2 years' time, artists of independent ilk. Even ones that are signed to major labels that, you know, if you listen to Top 40 radio, there are a handful, you can count them on your hand, of the artists that get play. And they get it regardless of what they put out because they signed long-term record deals, 7 albums if you're Lady Gaga, so they need to play that song somewhere. So like a commercial, they pay for it to be played.
I think a lot happens with copycats in that something gets big somehow, like, you know, the Mumford and Sons. Somehow that like gets big, and then now everybody is looking for the next Mumford and Sons.
But the question I have, and this is the question, I want to preface by saying I don't know if it's wrong. It's just the way business. I don't know how the business works. Does an Atlantic Records go find a Mumford and Sons because that's hot, and then do they say, okay, we're going to play the Lumineers like crazy. We're going to buy, you know, airplay. We're also going to book them on this tour and everything we possibly can do as a major label concept. But to you and me at home, when I hear the Lumineer song, the automatic sort of feeling as a consumer is, wow, that's a great song. These guys made it to the top. But I'm not sure if they made it anywhere, right? I mean, the concept being they signed with a record label, and that record label paid thousands of dollars to a radio station to play it. If that continues, I mean, because I remember when I went to even Columbia College and it was early days of doing radio production. This would have been 1994, 1990, you know. I remember having a producer in class where we had to research and look into the payola and plugola scams of the 1950s, which almost took down Dick Clark. It was the other guy that got it. I forgot his name, but the other guy got in trouble for it. That essentially, they were involved in trying to promote certain types of bands. And it feels to me, watching the Grammys last night and listening to all the people who are on the Grammys or all the people you can listen to on the on Top 40 radio today, you know, not missing a beat. There was nobody in there where you're like, oh, Bruno Mars, I've never heard of this guy. I wonder what his song is. I mean, really, the only one was Chance the Rapper. That's what scared me. There was a part of me that, as a longtime Chance the Rapper fan, I mean, you know this if you listen to this program. I've talked about Chance. We play his music. He's one of the big white whale in the sense that I can't get him to come on the show. It's too big. But I've always been a huge fan. Saw him at Pitchfork. You know, want to do everything you possibly can to see him on any seek him out and seek out performances and mixtapes and everything you possibly can. And watching him last night win for Best New Artist and Best Rap Album and to perform and essentially snatch the Grammys, I was like, slow your roll. It's just like, you know, I like Chance the Rapper as an artist, as even if it's independent means something different. You know, I just like the idea that, you know, he can create and I can consume. And I don't need to wait for the new Chance the Rapper to come on, you know, the different radio stations. But I wonder if that day is over. I wonder if the Ariana Grande featuring Chance the Rapper is 2 seconds away.
Somehow the new next Chance the Rapper ends up in your iTunes unexpectedly. It just shows up there like the U2 record.
Yeah, exactly. That's what's going to happen. It's going to be an Ariana Grande featuring Chance that just pops up. And it's going to be like all, it's going to be all Lionel Richie covers. And you're like, ah, man, come on. And not the soulful, not the Brick House type stuff. More the Hello.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, and it's interesting because I was trying to have this conversation not too long ago with the Grammys last night, you know, because I thought it was interesting that Ed Sheeran, who's the guitar player kid who's from England, I don't know why, because he was on Saturday Night Live and he played on Saturday Night Live. And my wife was like, meh. You know, like she's not really into the English rap, acoustic guitar rap, mm-hmm. Right? So I looked him up, and I started looking into his story, just kind of like Googling who he was, where he came from. And I guess he comes from the same, like, record producers and record company as Adele and as One Direction.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're all from the same, they're this English, you know, sort of they broke to come to the States. And he was actually helped out big time by Taylor Swift. And I'm like, when you start throwing these names around and all these people who, like, you know, he worked on the records and but also like how he got to the United States and he did his big shows. He did his own shows at Madison Square Garden, 3 sold out shows. I'm like, and that's when he got the attention of Pharrell. Pharrell is the one who really moved him to the top. I have so many questions. Reading that Wikipedia or whatever it was, I'm like, what? Huh? Ooh, you're skipping like a whole chapter. Like, I was just like, I don't understand how that's possible. And I wonder if that's, you know, that's just part of when we talk about the destruction or the idea that the record industry, the music industry has declined or collapsed or what have you, is that's the part that's collapsed. That you have to sign with Atlantic Records because Atlantic Records is, or whoever's going to send, you know, is going to spend the money, which is your money, spend the money to put you on the radio, things like that. Now there's none of that surround. So what?
Well, and on to a smaller scale, Bloodshot Records, a record label that we talk about quite a bit here. We have a lot of artists. We had the owners of the label on, a well-known Chicago label, been around for 20 years. They had their first ever Grammy nomination. Robbie Fulks was nominated for a Grammy for his record and his song.
Yeah.
Like, how they've been putting out great music.
Forever.
You know, for a long time. Why did that music, why did that one get?
Because we've had them on. I wonder if they would be, I mean, how does that happen? Is it like, you know, remember we had, wow, what's the guy's name who does the show Adam Ruins Everything, Adam Conover.
Mm-hmm.
He's on the show, and that's the concept. And one of the episodes was talking about how that happens in the Emmys and Golden Globes. Like, there's no such thing as just someone had a great show and now we're going to win a Golden Globe. There's so much that that the industry pours in, and there's a whole there's a lot of money that's thrown around before you even win Best New Artist. And I just like to know what goes into that. Like, I would like to peel back the curtain a little bit and be like, oh, that's interesting. You had to do this, and you had to do that, and you had to do this to even get yourself in consideration for a Grammy.
Yeah, I think Robbie said that he had been, he put his face in front of the people that vote and kind of took a part in various local academy type things that were happening around town. And all of a sudden, you know, next thing you know, more people know who he is, more people vote.
It's fascinating. I'd love to have Abraham back. You know who we should have back who I really enjoyed talking to was the band Celine Neon.
Yeah.
They were in and they performed live, and we were talking about how pop music works and how they wanted to be in that realm. It'd be interesting. Hey, I could ask the guys from My Gold Mask, too.
I was, this is how dumb I am, though. I was watching, you know, the Grammys, and I saw Ed Sheeran, and I was like, can you believe it? He was playing Saturday Night Live last night. Like, I'm still shocked by plane travel in 2017.
Apparently his band didn't make it, though. Like, he just played where he just looped himself. He was, so creative with his looping. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's probably, he just didn't want to spring for the plane tickets for the rest of his band from New York. Thanks, Rob. Welcome back to The Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in Studio 435 tonight, My Gold Mask. Wow, that's going to be fun, man. That's one of my favorite segments of the week. Live music in studio right here on Michigan Avenue. We're going to have a blast coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, next month, the new movie Trainspotting 2 is going to hit theaters 21 years after the original took the states by storm. It was fun going back and watching the trailer today just to refresh my memory on the characters and just remembering time and place from when I was, you know, 20 years ago watching Trainspotting. The movies are based on the brilliant novels and characters written by Irvine Welsh. Welsh, a Scottish-born writer, has lived all over the world, but currently living right here on the north side of Chicago. He worked at Columbia College in the fiction writing department for a minute, and that's where he met his collaborator and longtime friend, Don DeGrazia. DeGrazia is also a novelist. He got great reviews and acclaim for his work, American Skin. The two have collaborated on a new project that is many things in many ways, but for our conversation tonight, it's a rock opera called Creatives. It's going to be on stage at the Edge Theater in Edgewater through March 5th. It's part of the Chicago Theater Workshop, which is an incubator for new and innovative works here in town. Irvine Welsh, Don DeGrazia are in studio with me tonight. Guys, thanks for being here. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So I want to talk all about both of your careers and talk about the work, but let's get right to Creatives, because this is something, as just kind of looking through the last couple years of this, this is a project that has been a screenplay, it's been a regular play, it's now a rock opera. Talk about this project and why you guys keep coming back to it.
Well, it started, I would say, I don't know, like at least four or five years ago. We've been good friends for a long time, and actually neighbors for a long time there on the north side. And so we hang out, we run into each other, that sort of thing. And we ran into each other, as was common, on the street on Southport. And we went into a bagel shop, got something to eat. And from that conversation came this idea that we're talking about stuff, right? And from that conversation came this idea that we should write this, we should spend our summer writing this screenplay. And that's how this saga started. So.
Yeah, I mean, it was a way of avoiding kind of wasting the summer in bars and sort of,
watching the Cubs.
Watching the baseball and stuff. So we decided we're going to do something productive. And we just went for it. It was quite nice. It was quite a fun, organic process. We didn't really have any big expectations of it. And we saw it originally as a very 12 Angry Men type sort of, very kind of independent, kind of quite a rough independent local film made here, which had been good fun. And then we realised that because it's all happening in one space, it is a classic black box, play more. And I think with, because it was quite talky as we perceived it.
Okay.
And it is something that probably lends itself more to theater than to cinema. You're not using the full potential.
And it's really about a class. I mean, at the heart of it, it's about a music class. Tell us about it.
Yeah, it's about a classroom, and kind of to piggyback on what Irvin was talking about as far as the evolution of this thing. When we got into it, rewriting it as a play, it's still kind of a screenplay, becoming a play. This guy, a friend of ours, Pat McKenna,
who was from Second City, of course.
He was having a series at the Public House Theater called Put 'Em Up,
yep.
where there would be live
stage readings, right?
Yeah. So we did that. We got actors for all the roles and got a nice big audience there. And Tom Mullen, the guy who did really a great stage adaptation of Trainspotting here in Chicago, Trainspotting USA actually, mm-hmm. Set in America, you know. He came, of course, and then he was part of the team after that. And he got really into musical theater at some point. But
I think that was when he was 8 years old.
Yeah. At some point in the womb. He proposed this idea to us, and I think we were both sort of like, absolutely not, man. That's not any at all what we had in mind.
We walked out of that bar going, nah, no way. Then by the time we got down the road, we thought, maybe.
And this was the idea to turn it into a musical or an opera.
Well, if you want to be technical, it's a pop opera, or as the people really in the know call it, a popra. So
they do. Okay, yeah. Good. Thank you for.
I learned that
being technical
like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, right. So I mean, when you guys were, when that was, that idea was brought to you, this concept of taking your words and essentially turning it into a different art form. I mean, I would assume that beyond just sort of the shock of it, of saying, okay, well, we don't really know much about it. I mean, it's a challenge. I mean, for writers to actually make that transition to actually making music. Out of your words, there's something more of a challenge to that.
Yeah, and I think the interesting thing about it was that it's quite dark, you know, the subject matter, and it's quite a challenging, very kind of serious piece in some ways. And we thought, does the levity of the form of the musical format kind of does it not kind of push against it a little bit?
Yeah, right.
But I think we managed to get a kind of balance, didn't we? I think.
Yeah, and I do think I'm. I joke about the different terms and stuff, but there was a reason why Tom was stressing that it's not a musical. This pop opera approach uses music, I would say, to kind of I wouldn't say exactly, but similar to like a soundtrack in a film or something
that.
It accentuates the narrative storyline, as opposed to
tells a part of the story.
That's a different. I mean, mm-hmm. that gives you guys a lot of leeway in creativity and what music you're going to use and how you're going to use it, as opposed to having to push the storyline forward, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah, I mean, we kind of we basically just contacted, because it's a small scale production. We're starting off in a workshop format to try and to develop it and hopefully kind of. Grow from there. But we wanted to have kind of really sort of interesting songs, a mixture of kind of composed songs that Lawrence, our composer, has been doing, and kind of big kind of anthemic kind of sort of mm-hmm. songs. So we kind of approached bands directly to give us some for nothing, let us use them for nothing in this format, because we can't afford to license them, basically. So we got like New Order and Iggy Pop and Simple Minds.
Chance the Rapper.
We've managed to kind of pull favors, really.
Well, it's interesting, too, and we'll talk more about Trainspotting, but, that the music that was actually in the film, it became more than the movie at a certain point. I mean, the music, you hear some of the tracks that are actually from that movie 21 years ago. You think Trainspotting. You don't necessarily think plot. You think mm-hmm. moment. You think feel. You think emotion. There's something about what music can do to a piece of work.
I think
work.
That's what it does. And, you put it right, Don. It feels more like a kind of, it does feel like a kind of the way that music would be used in film. It feels more kind of, but obviously the the cast are all talented musicians, and they're playing the songs, mm-hmm. and performing the songs. But it is, you know, it does feel that the music's being used in the piece as a sort of as a kind of moody
soundtrack.
Sort
of, yeah.
Yeah, and then there's another level too, which is the fact that the characters, the fictional characters, are writing and performing.
They're performers, right?
So it's still not a musical in that sense, but there's a lot of music. You know?
Loads of music. Yeah.
Don DeGrazia and Irvine Welsh in studio tonight. Their rock opera is going to be on stage, called Creatives. It's on stage through March 5th. When does it start? Does it start this week?
Previews start this Thursday night, and then every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday for the next 3 weeks.
There you go, till March 5th. All right, so we'll take a quick break. We'll come back more with the guys here on The Download. Stay with us. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman in studio with me today. I would say you're a Chicago author now. I was going to say Scottish author, but say Chicago author, Irvine Welsh. Don DeGrazia as well. Irvin, of course, the writer of the novel Trainspotting and Porno, which is the follow-up, which is really what's based Trainspotting 2, right? I mean, that's the...
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting how that evolved. You know, it started off... you know, the original drafts, I mean, the book's about 15 years old, 14 years old, so the first drafts of it were round about then. And I'm actually glad that we couldn't get it made for all different reasons then, because it would have been, the guys would have been in their early 30s rather than their mid to late 40s. So it would have been about, another young person's film, really. It would have been, you know, just been about the kind of, the further daft capers of these kind of crazy guys, basically. Whereas this one is like, because of the, you've got the mortality and the aging and the kind of there's a lot more emotional levels to it, I think.
Yeah, it's I mean, and I want to get to characters and both of your characters for both the work that you guys do and how it works with creatives as well. You know, when you think about it, when you're writing characters, especially the characters that we saw in Trainspotting, the four guys, there's not that many times where an author gets a chance to write them again years later in their life. And you know, for Porno, the idea of being that in the same themes and the same, you know, questions they have about the life that they're living comes out decades later. I mean, there's something, what is that process like for the writer?
It's interesting because, we don't really, you know, we live in a very individualistic, narcissistic culture now, and we don't really change in the way that we used to. We kind of age a lot differently in terms of our interests and all that. And the digital world has made the whole division between kind of youth and middle age a bit more blurred now, because, you know, people listen to the same stuff. It's digitalized. I mean, kids now listen to Pink Floyd and all that stuff,
right.
And it seems bizarre that. You know, to do that, but it's only because of, you know, the whole death of culture between kind of about 1998 to about 2008, and it's coming back again now, and that's why everybody's so obsessed with it. But yeah, I mean, it is a nice opportunity, and I think when you write characters that are memorable, you take an interest in them, so you do just keep coming back to them anyway. Yeah?
Well, for both of you guys, I mean, when we talk about creatives and the project you're both working on now, and this also goes for American Skin, when you talk about characters and you're writing characters, are you guys writing the story of creatives, or are you writing the characters that, you know, that are in that world? I mean, what comes first for you guys?
That's a good question, and I mean, I don't know if I sound like I'm being evasive by saying both simultaneously, but that's the immediate answer that comes to mind. We sit down with a concept. I guess the concept for this papra was what came first, I would say. And then we started to fill this place with characters and just put them in situations and kind of see what happens.
I don't know much about it because I haven't seen it, but I will say that, not unlike Trainspotting, I mean, in Trainspotting, the theme which was resonated through is this: what kind of life do you want to live? Mm-hmm. You know, like, you could live the life of, you know, having a wife and kids and go home, or you could be, you know, like the main characters in Trainspotting that want to do everything they possibly can to to not end up there, right? So they're going to choose a different path. When I hear creatives and I read the synopsis, it's similar in the way that a lot of musicians come together in a class where a teacher is teaching them about music, and they have to sort of make a decision on where they want to go in their lives. When you're writers, when you guys are putting that kind of stuff together, what when I think about character arcs and characters, I mean, you really have, I mean, you have that sort of theme. What are you going to do with your life? But it's the characters that make the work work.
Yeah, sometimes I think you have to kind of almost, you know, trust the characters you create to start to tell the story, you know, and they, you know, they will start to do that, I think. I think a character who doesn't come with some story isn't really, it's not working as a character. They have to have a, they have to have the story kind of, you know, you have to have a sense of who they are and where they came from and what they're about and what, you know, what things they like and don't like. So you've kind of, there is that kind of, it's not like a hard dichotomy between character and story. They are kind of sort of, the interface all the way, basically. And it's very, you know, it is very difficult. Again, I mean, it's interesting when you work with someone else because I tend to let the subconscious do the heavy lifting and not really that, you know, not think about, you know, things too much. And it's like kind of, we'll just wrap something out, really, and then you look back, don't you? We just sit there. It's almost like, wrapping, isn't it? We're sitting at a desk just going, do-do-do-do, brum, bum, bum, brum, bum, bum. And then you start to kind of, you look at what you've got as a kind of pattern. You see characters developing in a certain way. You see kind of, and then it's like, you know, trying to impose some kind of order and discipline on the whole thing, and, you know, making the whole thing work together.
It might be analogous to a jam session or something, just sitting and just fiddling around and maybe keeping it on tape, and then going back and listening to what you have and seeing some patterns that emerge. And it has been, there's been a lot of discovery along the way, and it's, you know, right up until very recently, because this we've really gone back and reworked the story a lot, and a lot of that has really been a matter of heightening themes and storylines that, like Irvin said, have emerged apparently from our subconscious. You know, so.
Well, I mean, okay, I've
got the
a couple
actors
of questions
as well. Yeah. You know, so when you get a bunch of actors, that changes everything too, because and you get to, as a writer, you get, you're not, as a writer, you don't work with actors so much and in movies, but on stage you do more. You do have a lot more to do with them. And the interesting thing about working with actors is that they're all storytellers too. You know, they're telling stories all the time, and they're telling more than you. The actor's kind of constantly doing loads of jobs every year and getting in loads of different inside loads of different roles and heads and all that. So they're an incredible resource, and they change the whole thing as well, don't they?
Yeah, and once this thing got cast, for instance, it gave us a clear vision in our mind's eye of who each character was.
Oh,
that's not to say that the characters that are going to be depicted on stage are the real people who are playing them. Absolutely not. But something about
does
their energy.
Does it help you as writers to do that, to have that experience?
Yeah, it does me. I mean, I kind of, I mean, I like writing books because you're just on your own. You can do everything. You know, you can play God. But you get quite lonely if you're doing it all the time. And I think that for me, if I work in stage or I work in theatre or kind of work in, or screen, it's a whole different kind of way of looking at things and doing things. But it is so energizing, you know, and you take a lot of that energy into a book with you, I think.
So much different than sitting alone in a room looking at a piece of paper or a blank screen and just words, as opposed to sitting through a rehearsal, especially in a production like this, where, you know, between actual scenes and stuff, these actors are, you know, plinking on their ukuleles and, you know, testing out their voices.
I guess I never thought about that as writers and novelists. I mean, the idea that you can use the rehearsal process for a play to actually help inform how these characters grow in the drafts of your work, that's impressive. That's interesting.
We're talking about Second City and Pat McKenna. I mean, I just, another play that I've done, I just had a reading with them just a couple of weeks ago. And that's just, you know, the feedback I had from that has just changed the whole draft again, you know. So, I mean, it's like, I think it's particularly useful for stage because actors that are on stage, they know so much about how things are physically going to work out as well, you know, and that kind of helps inform you when you're writing. It makes you a better writer, I think.
Irvine Welsh and Don DeGrazia in studio with me, two Chicago authors. The new rock opera, the Popera, is called Creatives. It's on stage at the Edge Theater in Edgewater as part of the Chicago Theater Workshop through March 5th. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk about those characters. I mean, this really is a Popera about struggling artists and trying to find your voice. And again, sort of going at the idea of what this life is that they're living. And we'll talk more with the writers who are in studio, and we'll pick up after the news. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. 720 WGN. It's the download here till 11 o'clock with you this hour. Irvine Welsh and Don DeGrazia in studio talking about their new Popera, Creatives, which is going to be the Edge Theater in Edgewater through March 5th, part of the Chicago Theater Workshop. Don DeGrazia is a novelist. He had a great that American Skin. I remember at a different radio station talking about that. That was a big novel and a Chicago. I mean, you sort of became. You guys had like a run there, like the Chicago novelists.
And it's interesting, actually, with that book, the story, the backstory is I couldn't get anyone here to look at it. And I was kind of, you know, down about the whole process of trying to get it published. And then a professor of mine, this guy Andy Allegretti, showed me the New York Times Sunday magazine. And the cover of it was The Beats of Edinburgh. And it was a picture of all the Scottish working class fiction movement that had emerged and just taken the UK by storm. And at the center of it all was this guy, Irvine Welsh, who had written this book, Trainspotting. And it was very exciting. And they mentioned his new publisher, which was Jonathan Cape, that had picked up a lot of these authors. So I went and I sent my book cold to them, and they ended up publishing it.
Oh,
so
wow.
That's really the origin of this.
Yeah, that's an origin story. That's good. Irvine Welsh sitting right next to you. the man who brought us Trainspotting, the novel, and which was adapted to the movie Trainspotting. Trainspotting 2, which is really off of the follow-up Porno, but also just the characters. Trainspotting is going to be in theaters coming up here in the next month. I mean, for you to look back, I mean, to recognize it's been 21 years. And to have these characters actually live in that space, to be, you know, I don't know if it's accurate in reality, like reality, but the idea that you're coming back to this story, how does that make you feel?
It's interesting. I mean, it's like you kind of to get a film adapted is all. I mean, I've had like 5 books made into films now, and 3 of them have taken 15 years, you know, and. One took 3 years. The first one, Trainspotting, one, The Acid House, took a year. And the rest have all taken 15 years, like Porno, Ecstasy, Trainspotting 2, and Filth have all taken 15 years for various reasons. So I get it from, you know, because I wrote the book 15 years ago that it's based on, it doesn't feel like. You know, it's obviously not 20 for me. You know,
oh, right.
And you know, and the book was published maybe about a few years before the film. So it's kind of, you kind of break it down in that way, really.
Yeah. It's interesting, too. I mean, the fanfare, we were kind of talking in the break about how many people still will come out, even for events that you guys are involved in, for creatives, to sort of fans of Trainspotting. I mean, it really had an impact. Are you surprised at the impact it had, especially here in the States? I mean, it, obviously being a Scottish film and a film that really resonated in the UK.
Yeah, we had a lot of help. These were the days where you could kind of sucker right-wing politicians into making a moral sort of... you know, a moral attack on kind of these films that debase people. Now they're actually too busy debasing people in power with to kind of to bother about all that kind of thing. Yeah, I mean, it's something that. Sorry, I've lost the.
No, I mean, the idea that there's such fandom for it still, 21 years later.
People holding on for, you know, people still into it. I mean, you know, it's. My Twitter feed, and everybody in the UK has been sending, you know, for that generation have been saying how emotional it felt, you know, being kind of seeing that sort of, you know, because people immediately, you know, if they're off that generation, they look at themselves and look at their own lives and look at what's happened and all that, and they start to think about all the choices they've made, and they get really emotional. You know, I mean, I get stuff on Twitter about people who've kind of who went to the first film together and have gone to the second film together and all that, as a group of them.
Yeah, right.
And it's just weird how, you know, how much it's kind of meant to people. And I mean, they've been going to see it in their droves. I mean, I think we kind of for 18 certificate films, I think only we're behind 50 Shades of Grey, and I think Hannibal is the, you know, the third British British box office for 18 certificate of all time. Basically, you know.
I mean, it's such a, it almost, if you think about it, it really was, it was a perfect time for it here in the States. There was really a taste for independent film, especially film that was coming in that, that wasn't necessarily the same tribe that you see over and over and over, the formulaic stuff that was passing as independent film. Once Trainspotting came out and done, I feel like that was, so it was something brand new, the novel and the
it
and
changed,
the movie.
It changed, cinema, it changed the whole thinking on independent film, and it changed literature quite a bit. There's just no doubt about it. That book has been enormously influential, and the fact that, you know, I have students now who are just coming out of their teens or whatever, and there are many of them are all about that book, you know, which is not a brand new book, as we've established.
Well, you know, the conversation we were having before the break was really about characters, and the characters that are in Trainspotting are, I mean, there's something great about, we've been talking about this whole hour, just how they get back together. But there is something about those characters and their stories and how they deal with what's expected of them in life. Is what makes that story. Let's talk about creatives in the way that the characters that you guys have put together or that you've created for this, for creatives, is the same concept of struggling artists. Artists that are trying, musicians who are trying to figure out their way. Are they going to be a pop star that goes after the Grammy? Are they going to be the independent artist that does something different? But these are archetypes in the way that, you know, these are things that musicians have to go through. But as writers, what do you bring to the characters from your own experiences that make these characters unique?
Well, I think we approached it very consciously by looking at songwriting as another form of storytelling, which, you know, is what we do, you know, in prose. So using that as an avenue to relate to these characters first and foremost, I think was the key. But also, I mean, we're both very, you know, it's not unique, but we're both very serious about music and even pop music. You know, we're it's just an absolutely important part of our lives. So that was definitely a fuel for this as well. So,
yeah. Oh yeah, without a doubt. And when you start to think of it in musical terms, and then it becomes it starts off as being a bit daunting, because, you know, neither of us are particularly au fait with the musical as a form, but when you start to think about it in these terms, you just get really excited. You know, you just start thinking about music, and you start thinking about the type of people that listen to certain types of music, and that begins to inform the characterization. You know, we've got we have people who are right on, as you say, that kind of, you know, independent sort of pure, like independent rocker, pure artist kind of. This is me expressing myself, mm-hmm. and, you know, to hell with the world. And you've got the very kind of market-driven American Idol aspirant type of person, and where it is about sort of it's principally about fame and money rather than sort of any kind of expression at all. And you've got everything really in between, you know. So, and that's really what the book's about, isn't it? It's about music and the commodification of music and music as kind of protest, and where all that sits within our culture presently. And it's all about that kind of cultural appropriation, isn't it? So it's very much of its time. It's very much about characters who are kind of contesting these cultural wars between them.
Yeah, and I would say that even at the characters that are different ends of the spectrum, I would say that none of these characters are are wholly represent one. Like the purists, there's a part of them that still would like some affirmation, some fame, some money. The people who have achieved that want some credibility. You know,
it's like real life. Yeah, right? There's no absolutes in this stuff. Yeah. You know, for you guys, you know, Don, you grew up here, and you know, American Skin was a Chicago book. I mean, Irvine, you talked about being here for 6, 7, 8 years now. Uh-huh. You know, for you to put this up in an Edgewater theater to do a popra, you know, for both of you had the success that you've had in your careers to be able to have this experience where you're putting up a play in a small black box theater on in a nondescript north side of, you know, the city of Chicago. How does that feel? I mean, is that in step with what you guys are talking about?
Yeah. It makes us feel really edgy and like we're keeping it real, man. That's my answer. I'm sticking to it.
No, it's a joy. I mean, it's like, you know, just coming off Trainspotting 2 and working on that and still, you know, promoting it. It just feels like a huge monolithic thing that you just have to kind of grab it by the, you know, it's like grab the tiger by the tail and you get pulled along and all that. But you've no control over anything or you know, it's a machine that just runs. And with this, it feels just nice to be working with people very, you know, and just, you know, you're back at a kind of level where there's not perhaps a big expectations, a big commercial expectations, you know, just on the last project, but in some ways, it kind of these are the kind of things that reignite your passion.
I agree, and I would say that I personally, you know, Irvin's done stage plays before and that sort of thing. I was psychologically resistant to certain aspects of what I saw myself being pulled into, but I got pulled into it just the same. And now, at this point, I'm on the same page with Irvin. It's just really exciting. It's fun. I didn't realize how much fun it was going to be, and inspiring. All of these things that are genuinely true about what this process has become.
Well, in some ways it's life imitates art, as you guys said, great creatives, and you know, with the success that you've had, both of you, you know, to be able to do this in a small black box theater for reasons that are creative. I mean, I don't know if at the end of the day you guys are thinking that the agent's going to walk through the door and be like, gotta check this out.
Well, we got to write that into the actual story. Right. But one of the things that's been built into this that makes it so nice is, you know, it's the Chicago Theater Workshop, and the operative word there is workshop. It calls itself an incubator for new works. The emphasis is all on development and taking chances and all that. So I'm not going to say it totally takes the pressure off, but it makes it a more creative environment.
And it makes it a kind of environment where the thing can actually grow organically, because you can kind of, you know, as a theater workshop, you're constantly developing it as you go along. So you need the feedback from the audiences. Yeah. You need people to say, you know, to let you know this was working well, this wasn't working so well, and what can you do about it and all that. And I think that's the spirit we're going into. And we're seeing it as very much, you know, an opportunity to kind of we've made a creative statement. We've made, you know, the musicians and the actors and all that are making a creative statement. But these things always work, you know, it's a Chicago play, it's about Chicago. These things always work if there's a good, strong interface with the community. You get it right, you kind of miss, you know, with the best bill in the world, there's always a reference. It's not, you know, a musical reference or a local reference. I mean, Don's kind of Mr. Chicago, he's steeped in it, basically. And, you know, there's certain things that kind of, whatever you do, the music references or whatever, they just slip under the net and all that. They're not quite right. And that's when you get feedback from people saying that, you know, even the way the actors are dressed and stuff like that, it all improves it. It all authenticates that experience. It makes it stronger. And it kind of makes it kind of resonate as a statement about where we are, you know, and who mm-hmm. we are.
Authors Irvine Welsh and Don DeGrazia in studio. Their popra, Creatives, is on stage at the Edge Theater in Edgewater starting this weekend through March 5th, part of the Chicago Theater Workshop. Can't thank you guys enough for coming in and talking about your art.
Thanks so much, man. Yeah.
And good luck with the show.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Love talking to those guys.
Right? How great was that?
I just said that to the microphone and to Pete in the window, and my gold mask is warming up, and they just answered, as you would.
Yeah.
It's always weird in radio because I'm talking to a lot of different people in different ways. It's funny. But it was good, right? That was fun. It's amazing to think about. I mean, Trainspotting being 21 years old. And there's something to it. I mean, when you think about, like Urban was saying, this concept that people went and saw it in 1996, you know, and as with a group, and then they went 21 years later to watch the next one. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Were you a Trainspotting guy?
Was.
Right?
Oh, yeah.
Such
right
a
in my wheelhouse.
Yeah. Such, yeah, there's some really great stuff in that movie. It really, and it's amazing to think about how it does stand the test of time. Like today I was going through and I was doing a bunch of just sort of like a refresher of the movie, you know, watching the trailer and doing everything I can besides watching the movie to get up to speed on those characters. It didn't take long. I was like, oh man, Ewan McGregor, the young Ewan McGregor.
Yeah.
He's young.
Every time Rose show starts, he plays Lust for Life. And I think of Trainspotting.
Right. Yep. I was telling these guys in the break that there was one of the first ever Schadenfreude sketches. And the group that I was in, the comedy group, we did a sketch. Did not work. It was terrible. It was one of the first ones we did. But the idea was, I think it was a scene, like we were trying to recreate one of the scenes from Trainspotting with the music and everything. And a guy was like taking heroin or whatever it was. And then like the lights shock and they come up and it's like, hi, I'm running for Senate. Like it was something where I was just making fun of how absurd the political commercials
were
at that time. Mm-hmm. It did not. No one laughed. But the point being that it was great that I'm like, wow, man, that was all because we were 2 days before sitting in the living room watching Trainspotting. And I just, again, and I know that I can be a total homer for this city, but the idea that the writer and creator of those characters in that movie and that book and Trainspotting 2 is creating a new work in a black box theater at the Edge Theater in Edgewater.
Right.
It's awesome.
That's great.
Right?
Just that he lives here.
I mean, there's one thing to say that you live here. I mean, this would be a good conversation because there's a lot of people who, you know, like Vince Vaughn. No, I live in Chicago. I'm from Chicago. But he doesn't really do anything here. You know, you're not going to see Vince Vaughn doing anything that's like a show, you know, like creating something in Chicago. He works in L.A., works in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And Irvin Welsh can do the same thing. You know, he'd go send his new manuscript in and, you know, have a new movie in London. He'd do whatever. But the idea that he is creating work that is specifically for the stages of Chicago, not just stages, but off-loop stages.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's amazing. That's, talk about giving back to your community.
He's totally allowed to go to the Cubs World Series game if he so desires. Exactly. Just doesn't have to fly in.
Exactly. That's what we need next time when the Cubs are in the World Series this year and they go around to Cusack and Vaughn. And Irvin Welsh is here. Okay. The Trainspotting author. I love that movie. Oh, that's great. Joe Buck. Talking about, remember that one 21 years ago. Yeah, it was great though. That's, and Don too. Don DeGratz's book American Skin, that got a lot of great reviews at the time. I remember that was, it was him and Joe Mino, who's been on the program.
Yeah.
And there's a tremendous Chicago literary scene. When you talk about some of the writers who had novelists have come through, and I think of Columbia College specifically. There's more, but Don, Joe Mino, Audrey Niffenegger, who did Time Traveler's Wife, mm-hmm. she's from Columbia College. And there's a lot of great talent here in Chicago that works in schools and works, you know, I forgot who was telling us, it was about theater. We were talking theater, maybe it was last week before the wrap, but the idea that there's so many opportunities for artists in Chicago because of the universities, because of the different places that you can do things, that it gives people a chance. So a lot of great stuff tonight. Urban Welsh. Awesome to have the guy who created Trainspotting in.
The best.
It's The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, you heard there, Michael Flynn out as National Security Advisor. Interesting, as Don just pointed out on text. Okay, who replaces him. So that's going to be the dance of the week as we see who replaces Michael Flynn and the national security role. Wow. Some breaking news late in the 10 o'clock hour.
I know, and Schwarzenegger's on the outs.
See, if they didn't have this problem, Schwarzenegger would have been perfect. America would have loved to have an Arnold Schwarzenegger running national security. Ugh. It's just like... I also saw this, before we get into Studio 435, my gold mask standing by, that this is the year of the movie Running Man. Remember the Running Man movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he was like, it was like, what was it, Richard Dawson was the guy who was like, oh, all right, and they made the criminals do like a whole reality show murder thing. And it was like in the mid-80s.
Oh, yeah.
It took place in the year 2017. We're living Running Man. We really are.
We are Running Man.
All right, it's time for Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music that Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on Michigan Avenue. Tonight, we bring you the sounds of My Gold Mask. The duo Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando are much more than a rock band. They experiment with dance sounds, almost electronic music, industrial percussion. It's what is referred to as dark pop. We'll talk what dark pop means. The result, a unique, nuanced sound mixing Greta's voice with an awesome wall of sound, which can be heard in the 26th album, Anxious Utopia. They're playing at Talia Hall in Pilsen this Saturday night, but first they're live in Studio 435. Greta, Jack, good to see you. Thanks for being here.
Hey. Thanks for having us.
All right, so let's talk about this. I love the record. I think it's great. I was listening to it all day.
Thank you.
I'm very, I guess I'm happy because I was able to jack it up because the Roe Con show in the afternoon, we're at the auto show. So there was nobody down here. So like a teenager, I just jacked the speakers up and listened to
it. It's better to turn it up. It sounds better loud.
So talk about, I mean, did I categorize that correctly? The idea of dark pop, this sort of, it's almost an experimental sound that you guys are putting together.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't even know what to call it. So
we're still experimenting with it, I think.
I mean, pop is definitely a part of what we do. The dark pop comes from the fact that there is sort of a moodiness or a melancholiness, melancholia to it, you know, but it's still rooted in melody and all that kind of stuff. But emotion has always been... a driving thing for us. We kind of just go off our emotions and what we're feeling. But Anxious Utopia is something that we wanted. We intentionally had a dance, more of a dance beat going through most of the album and stuff like that. So.
Do you find yourself evolving from record to record as you put albums out? I mean, when you talk about experimenting, and that's a big part of the music that you put together. I mean, do you find yourself on each record trying something new
that you
didn't even think about before?
I think also at the end of a record, we kind of lay it to bed and start to move on with something else and explore other ideas, pick up other instruments, mess around with things that tickle
something.
Our fancy.
we like not to just fall into a rut and just kind of do the same thing that we were doing. I mean, creatively speaking, I think it's good to switch something up. If you're so comfortable, then it might not be the best thing for creative.
It's such an interesting. I mean, we just had the conversation with Don and Irvin, which was about musicians, and then even earlier, Bob Kester talking about jazz music. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's something about the idea that, okay, let's say that My Gold Mask and the tracks that easily could happen where something from Anxious Utopia clicks in the way that everybody loves the song. Everybody is just like, this is the best song I've ever heard.
Oh,
do
awesome.
Do you find pressure to replicate it, to stay with it, to format it, to make it your sound?
I mean, there could be pressure if you have some sort of a hit or something like that. But I think that it could be a trap creatively, and I think we experienced a little bit of that ourselves when Violet Eyes came out on our EP, A Thousand Voices. That's the closest thing we would have to a hit.
Yeah.
And it was all over the place. And I think that, you know, it's interesting, right? Because everyone wants a song to everyone. Everyone would love for everyone to, you know, connect
enjoy
with the
song.
Right?
Sure.
But at the same time, it sort of casts a shadow in a way, and you have to ignore it. You have to write remember why you're writing music and why you're doing what you're doing and not get caught up in the hoopla and all that kind of
Greta,
stuff.
Was that hard? I mean, after Violet Eyes, was it hard to think that, hey, this next record, we're going to experiment and do something entirely different?
It's funny because after Violet Eyes, I don't think that was actually what we were thinking. We were just exploring new ideas. I was still new to drums, so we were. I was having that struggle myself. But as far as I think, it wasn't until because we released an EP after A Million Miles
came after A Thousand Voices.
Yeah, and it wasn't until. Leave Me Midnight. Thank you.
Greta always mixes up. She blames me because some of
Thousand Voices, Million Miles.
Some of the titles were my idea, and Greta actually blames me for not being able to differentiate between.
She's like the red one.
What's funny you say that is whenever we do merchandise.
The red one is the one she's talking about. Actually.
Leave Me Midnight.
Yeah. The red one, Greta.
I think it was when I was we were writing the red one.
Yeah.
That was when I was definitely feeling like, oh, wait a second. I really want to maybe be able to tap into that again. And then we kind of hit a stride with that record. And I feel like that was our first complete, like,
where you guys really
from beginning to end. Yeah. It was like an actual, like albums for us.
Yeah, well, I think
in completion.
Right. I think Leave Me Midnight was like, yeah, it was if you put that album on, it's a very specific sound. It's probably the darkest thing we did. It's more of a wall of sound. It's sludgy in a way. It's dreamy. It's still got melody, but it's not like a dance album the way Anxious Utopia is.
Definitely not. I think it's very cohesive though. From beginning to end. And that was something I was really proud about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm proud of all of our records. But yeah, it's
most notably the red one.
But yeah, Greta's more proud of the red one, yeah.
But let's move on to the white one. Anxious Utopia.
But to illustrate, we're always kind of looking to push into different territory. So with Anxious Utopia, there is more of a lightness and in the sounds and the tones and everything.
Yeah.
That we were sort of...
We wanted like to do like the mirror.
A bookend, a mirror to
Leave
Me Midnight.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, it listening to Anxious Utopia, there's something, and we'll get to the live music just right here after the break, My Gold Mask in studio. There is something about it that mixes sort of what we've heard from artists like Robin and others, where it's this dance music that has become popularized in the last couple of years, and a throwback, that wall of sound to, I was thinking about early 90s where I can't think of the names of the bands, but like the wall of sound stuff that we even heard,
Shoegaze,
stuff, right? So am I in the right?
We've played with a lot of shoegaze bands and stuff.
My
like
Bloody
that.
Valentine, yeah, is that one of the bands?
Yes, those are definitely influences on us.
Yeah.
And that's what we're looking to. That's what we like to do. We like to confuse people, really. I mean, we do. You know, it's funny because people always, including ourselves, they always kind of struggle somewhat to place it into a place. There's a strength to that, and there's an up to that and a down to that. For us, though, our main thing is we're artists, we're musicians. If we just did something paint by numbers, we would not be satisfied with it. I mean, we just wouldn't, you know?
Musicians Jack Armando and Greta Rochelle are in studio. They are My Gold Mask. They are going to be at Thalia Hall in Pilsen this Saturday night. They're here in Studio 435. We'll take a break, get a sound check on you, and hear some live music. My Gold Mask in studio. Stay with us.
Awesome.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kopman. All right. I think we got a successful, we'll see if we had a successful sound check. We're working it down here on Studio 435, our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer right here in the Allstate Showcase Studio on beautiful Michigan Avenue. In studio, My Gold Mask, the duo Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando are here in studio. They are playing at Thalia Hall in Pilsen this Saturday night. But first, of course, they're here at Studio 435, the 2016 album Anxious Utopia. And here is the track live, Dangerous. Take it away, guys.
So anxious to see you, I drop everything. Your feet on my weakness, but I don't complain. Push bodies like blankets on top of my seat and dance with the devil to look at the pain. Dangerous, dangerous, dangerous.
Live in studio 435. Come up to the chairs here. Cool. There we go. The song Dangerous, the album Anxious Utopia. They're playing at Thalia Hall this Saturday night in Pilsen. They're live right now in studio 435. There you go. I have to say, like, I mean, that's, I, for, it was funny because I was just talking with a texter in the break and they said, so emo? I said, no, not emo. That's not, that's
one. No, we don't, that's one we don't use.
And I said, you're just going to have to listen to it. And yeah. And I think you pull out of that music, you a lot of I guess synth is the right word.
Oh yeah, a lot of synth.
Like, talk about what's in that song.
I mean, you know, in that song, like so many influences, really. And we should say there, you know, there's a person responsible for some of the sounds you're hearing that's not here tonight. His name is James Andrew. He worked on the record with us, and he did a lot of the electronic beats you're hearing right now. And influenced by a lot of dark synth stuff, maybe a lot of old Depeche Mode, stuff like that. But James also listens to a lot of hip-hop and stuff like that, so he mixed a lot of that in there. Greta's vocals Greta has a very unique vocal.
But there's also in the production of what you guys are doing. I mean, the vocals are so beautiful, but it's also the way that it just is this feel that it's rhythmic and it's circular.
Well, like you just said it, I mean, for us it's feel, and it's mm-hmm. it's all emotion and feel. We're concerned with genre in this group. We never sat there and said, you know, this is, you know, what's happened is we've been matched with certain genres. There's a lot of, if for lack of a better term, like people in the goth scene have embraced us. People that like a lot of shoegaze, like you were saying, have embraced us. But also a lot of people that just like pop music that isn't the stuff you hear all the time on the radio have embraced us. And then a lot of other people we've confused, and that's okay, you know? that's what
probably
we do.
More
that's what my gold mask is.
I was going to ask, I mean, for you guys, what is success? I mean, is success something where, you know, you want radio play, where you want that kind of
I mean, I don't
pop life?
I don't not want radio play. I don't not want, you know, any of that stuff. I think for Greta and I, though, really success is when we have some of the most amazing fans, and it's when they come to us and they come to a show and they connect with our song and they connect with what we're doing and we share that feeling with them and they're feeling it, then to me that's success, really.
Yeah, when you guys absolutely. Are both on stage mm-hmm. And you're my gold mask, is it just the two of you? I mean, you're,
yes.
There's no backup band or
now
anything?
There is.
So, now there is.
It's just us, yeah.
But the two of you, I mean, talk about what we see. I mean, is it essentially pressing the space bar on the computer and then the two of you? I mean, what is happening on stage for my gold mask show?
Well, I mean, there's
got a lot of.
I mean, there's usually, a little bit of pressing space.
Yeah, there's just a little bit of that. But I connect with my audience a lot, and I need them there. It is very much an AC/DC effect for me. It's a battery. I'm driven by them. So when I see their faces, it definitely helps me perform.
Yeah, but as far as you know, like.
Visually, you see, we usually have some graphics in the back, which I don't think we're going to be
able
to.
We always put on a show. But okay. But what you're hearing, a lot of what people don't realize, what you're actually hearing is a lot of the synths are actually my guitar. I've spent a lot of I'm playing nylon.
Yeah, it's an interesting.
It's a nylon string electric guitar. I'm running it through a guitar amp and a bass amp. I have a lot of pedals. That's the primary sort of sound that Michael Mask was built around, was that guitar sound. And so the electronics were, you know, they're not, are they a big part of what we do? Absolutely. But the sound, the uniqueness of the sound.
But there's a uniqueness regardless.
Is coming from the shaping of tones in my guitar in a certain way.
And you guys, I mean, and we'll get to it because I'm going to take a break to get to Rob and the news. But I also want to talk about your aesthetic when it comes to what you guys put out with your videos and what you do on stage. And we kind of talk a little bit about the graphics that are put up. But just this I mean, there's a lot of artistic license that you guys take in a great way to sort of tell stories through the videos and the stuff that you put together.
Cool,
so we'll talk more with My Gold Mask, Greta Rochelle, and Jack Armando in studio. The album is Anxious Utopia. They're going to be at Thalia Hall this Saturday in Pilsen. But right now, we're going to get some more music out of them coming up. But right now, let's take a quick break for the news. I'm checking to see. We don't have no sponsor, so let's go right to it. 10:31, here's Rob Martyr. All right, it's 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman at Studio 435. This, of course, our weekly shortcake. It's our weekly shortcake. Strawberry, usually. Our weekly showcase of the best live music Chicago has to offer. Tonight, the sounds of My Gold Mask, the duo Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando are in studio. with their experimental dance sounds, industrial percussion, dark pop, as we talked about. Their album, 2016 album, Anxious Utopia, they're playing at Thalia Hall this Saturday in Pilsen, but they're live right now. Here's a track from Anxious Utopia called Battles. Take it away, guys. Yes, so good. My Gold Mask in studio 435 tonight. That is, I love it. I love it. Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando, the duo that's My Gold Mask. They're playing at Thalia Hall in Pilsen this Saturday night. Their album is Anxious Utopia. Greta and Jack back at the table. That was great.
Thank you.
The song Battles.
That was fun. Thank you.
You know, it's funny because we were talking in the break about how a lot of that music, which, you know, to someone who's listening who doesn't know the backstory will say, okay, well, that could be arranged and developed in a lab,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the way that you, but it really does come organically. Greta, you played the drums, you sang and did the stand-up drums before. Mm-hmm. This is sort of the next generation of My Gold Mask.
Exactly.
Yeah, when we first started, actually, we didn't know what we were going to do percussion-wise, and somebody from a previous band had left an old kit, kind of broken down in our space. So I took the floor, the kick, and
and a floor tom.
And a floor tom eventually, and then was trying to just replicate like a four on the floor. And then like everything just...
That's how we started. Greta was a standing singing drummer, and I played this weird guitar, and that was it. That was all we did for a few years. We played shows that way, and everything we did was that way. We wanted to add more electronic stuff, and Greta, the thing is, Greta's an amazing front woman. And as awesome as she was behind the kit, and still is, and on albums like Leave Me Midnight, she played almost all the drums, except for a few few of the tracks. She's an even better front person. So freeing her up away from the drum kit and letting her like go around the stage and she live mixes her vocals.
Is it difficult for you guys, or I shouldn't say difficult, it's a challenge to make a transition from what you guys were doing.
Oh yeah.
To what we hear tonight.
Oh yeah,
that's been the fun.
It was
though.
A huge challenge.
We tried to introduce, or we tend to introduce, a new challenge for every release.
But I think you know, it's like I think people tend to think when you're doing something electronic that it's somewhat easier or something like that.
No.
But it was actually very difficult to switch from being an all organic group into mixing electronics with organic instruments in a way that works and sounds right. You can't just slap those sounds together and think that it's going to be okay. And we have help. We have Balthazar Delay has been there since day one with us from when we were just drums and guitar as an engineer. And he's sort of like the fifth Beatle kind of guy. And Sanford Parker is another producer we've worked with. And James Andrew, who we played live with up until very recently. He just moved to Portland. He left us.
Let me ask Greta, I mean, for you as a singer, as someone who, you know, when there's a lot going on, you know, whether it be the way that the synthesizers and the way that the electronic music, the industrial percussions, is it challenging as a singer to pick up where you're supposed to be and how you're supposed to sound when there's so many layers to the music?
Sometimes, yes, it is, actually. I try to... Well, that's why sound checks are so key for us. we've both come from bands where that would have not been such an issue. But, yeah, I just kind of focus on one kind of sonic that I just really, like, hone in on and follow that. But...
it's a different, you know, because everything's living in a different world.
Yeah, right.
It's also, you know, like whenever you're in a new space, a new venue, the acoustics are so different from place to place that it takes a couple of songs.
Yeah,
I would imagine
the way that the music actually bounces
and
off itself.
Just to find
is an issue.
My voice
and with
in the mix.
So all crazy. The effects, you know, I mean, Greta sings with so many effects. So, and then my guitar has 10,000 effects. So there's times it took... There were times in the practice space where I'm like, I don't think you're in key on the right note, and it's because not because you can't sing in key, but because you're hearing some kind of overtone
off of something else.
Overtone in my effects. So there's all kinds of different challenges.
Well, I mean, I can understand the music being done in studio, meaning, you know, I mean, you hear all the time so many great electronic bands are sound great in studio, and then you get live and it's a different kind of sound. But if you guys are trying to replicate what you have on the albums, then it sounds very similar, especially in here in a radio talk show studio. I mean, but there are a lot of challenges to be able to perform that.
And also it's, you know, we always sound a little bit more rock live than we do on our records. That's the way we like it.
I think it's our energy though, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We're both very intense people. And I think that comes across live.
We're intense, but we're a lot of fun, too.
Well, you're artistic. We're talking to My Gold Mask in studio here, Studio 435. They're going to be at Thalia Hall in Pilsen on Saturday. You know, you're artistic as well, like, because we talked a little bit before the break about the videos. Go check them out at the website. But I mean, there is this, you are going for an imagery, like that you are going for something. It's not just sort of your classic rock, you know, like video where you guys are all, but there's something with each one that there's an artistic statement, and you hear it as well in what you guys are doing album to album. Mm-hmm. How much of that is something that is part and parcel to what you do? Meaning that was why you got into this. You're saying not only are we musicians, but we're also artists trying to make statements.
Oh, there's a visual element. Obviously Greta and I both like, visual is definitely important to us. It's not something that's just a side note for us. But they have to go hand in hand. They have to, ultimately, the music, it has to match the music, it has to complement the music, and it has to work in tandem with it, you know.
We actually created a sigil for our logo, actually.
Our symbol,
now.
Yeah.
Our little symbol.
It's like our magic symbol. That
it is magic.
It has a little life of its own.
Yeah, and we incorporate that with a lot of our visuals now, too. Live, we like to use our projections, which we incorporate different...
But the videos, like that you were talking about, I mean, that, a lot of that is directors that come to us, and they want to... They're inspired by the music, and that's really cool, because that's another... artist that is inspired by the music, and they get an image in their head that might not be the image that we had necessarily in our head, but when they present it to us, we go, oh wow, that image, even though it wasn't our original image, it matches so beautifully.
Well, I mean, it says a lot about your music that it is visual. I mean, it's hard to say that about music, but your music and what you guys do are visual, what we're hearing here at 720 WGN tonight. My Gold Mask, the record is Anxious Utopia. They're playing at Thalia Hall in Pilsen this Saturday night. Let's take a break. We'll come back. We'll get one more live song from you.
Cool. Perfect.
All right. Sounds good. Stay with us.
Thank you.
It's 720 WGN, the Download, Studio 435. Of course, our weekly showcase. The best live music Chicago has to offer in the Allstate Showcase Studio tonight. My Gold Mask, the duo Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando are here. They do, I would say, dark pop is what we've landed on. Experimental dance sounds, electronic music, industrial percussions. A great mix that you can hear on the record Anxious Utopia, which just came out in 2016. They're going to be playing Thalia Hall this weekend, Saturday night in Pilsen. Here they are live in Studio 435, their last track tonight, the track called In Diamond White. Take it away, guys.
My head.
Yeah. Woo! My Gold Mask live in studio tonight. Yes, Greta Rochelle and Jack Armando. The album is called Anxious Utopia. They're going to play playing at Thalia Hall this Saturday night in Pilsen. That track was called In Diamond White. I can't thank you guys enough. I mean, it's great to have you guys here, but to watch you guys perform in studio with the instrumentation, but also the effects that you guys put on the music. It was quite a delight.
Thank
so I
you.
Appreciate it. Thanks for being here in studio. Oh,
this is a pleasure.
Well, that's going to do it for the download tonight. Tomorrow night. So excited about tomorrow night's show. Mike Doty's going to join us from Soul Coughing. Solo now, of course. Talk to him about his career. He's coming up. Also, Michael Ian Black from The State. A great comedian. And Al Genie's going to be back. Professor Al Genie. We had Professor Al Genie on not too long ago talking about the seven deadly sins, if you remember that program we did an hour. We really broke down what it meant, both from the sort of historical perspective and how to interpret it today. Well, we're going to do something similar tomorrow night with love. It's Valentine's Day. Why not do that, right? That sounds like a fun thing to do. So tomorrow, Al Genie in the 8 o'clock hour will be philosophizing about love. It sounds like a class I took at Columbia College, the philosophy of love. It was an elective that it was really hard to get into. It was early on, too, in my college days, before all of you, the next generation, you all got lucky in the way they could do it on computers. We still had to go from table to table. Stand in a line. And so I got lucky. You know what I did, Robbie, like this, is that I worked registration.
Well, there you go.
And if you worked registration, you not only got a great $5 an hour, but you would also get your pick of classes first. And so, heck yeah, when I got to my sophomore year, I was in philosophy of love.
Sure. Yeah.
A lot of real good.
Although, I don't know. I mean, stories. You know, being married, I don't know if there's much philosophy involved anymore. It's basically just do as I say.
There was a great article. I just saw it was a USA Today article. I just saw the headline on Facebook that said being married actually lowers stress. That if you're single, you have more stress than married.
All right.
Yeah.
I'll leave that one where it is.
Patty Vasquez up next. She is in studio. Patty Vasquez.
I agree with that.
You agree?
If you'd only put the laundry away, I would be so stressless. But the laundry's everywhere. How are you doing, Justin?
I'm doing good. I have a Valentine's Day problem. My problem is that it has been determined by my family that Valentine's Day is in the morning tomorrow.
Okay. So wakey-wakey.
Which is fine. I can do that. But it just means tonight I have to go assemble some stuff. You know,
yes.
And I was hoping I had all, you know, like I work at night. So I was like, well, you know, I thought I'd have a couple hours in the mid-morning, but instead I
no,
have.
No, it has to be a big awakening surprise.
Yeah.
Like Christmas morning. It's Valentine's Day morning.
It's Valentine's Day morning. I didn't know that. I come from a family where my mom and dad would be a card in a candy bar, and it'd be at night after we got back from school. Right?
Oh, see, that's a way to do it. Yeah.
So now I got to do all this stuff in the morning before the sun wakes up.
Reset the tradition is all I'm saying.
Yeah. Anyway, what's on the show tonight?
We have, we've got music for Music Monday. We have Paul Farvar, Rex Hupke from Chicago Tribune.
Great.
A little bit of news, apparently.
I know.
Michael Flynn was like, you know, on second thought, I got to be somewhere else.
There is a great, I just started to skim it in the break. The Washington Post has a piece tonight that actually forced this resignation.
Really?
About an hour ago. And it essentially said that the White House knew all along.
They knew
about these sanctions. They knew about the call. They knew everything. That's not what you want to hear, because everyone across the board from the president on up denied.
Justin.
And now you're hearing that they all knew about it.
Justin.
That's not good.
He's the president of the United States. Give him a chance. Let him do his thing and let's see what happens.
When you get to the point where there's one collective lie from
really,
the White House.
If you're going to overreact, the media just blows everything out of proportion.
And it
get
was
over
about
it,
a video.
Justin.
I know.
Blah,
everybody's
blah,
got
blah,
issues.
Russia. Blah, blah, blah.
We shall see. When you have the impeachment pool, you may want to look at your number, because that's not a good sign that everybody in the White House knew.
That's so much,
when you start to get a little sweat on the brow.
You'd rather be in the debt pool than the impeachment pool.
Yeah, yeah. All right. It shows all yours.